And ladies and gentlemen of the jury,
the prosecution is not going to get that man today.
No,
because I'm going to get him.
This is the Hagman & Hagman Report for today. It is a Thursday, March 28th, 2013. I'm Doug Hagman. With me is my co-host, the birthday boy, Joe Hagman. Folks, you're about to hear 3 hours of uncensored news, analysis, and information that we all need to know in these very perilous times. We broadcast live each and every weeknight from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. Of course, we see the far side of the news, and we deliver the important news in 3D. So don't forget to get your Hagman & Hagman Report 3D glasses before the broadcast. Our home base, of course, ladies and gentlemen, is HomelandSecurityUS.com. That's HomelandSecurityUS.com. And, of course, you can find us as well, some of my articles as well, at CanadaFreePress.com. And we want to say hello and thank you to our neighbors to the north. I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us today, and thank you for your belief, your continued belief, and your trust in us as we walk through this minefield of current events together. We want to say hello to the people in Australia. God bless you. You know who you are. Listeners there, thank you so much for all of your kind words, your support, your assistance, your graciousness in Australia. I want to say hello to the people listening currently in Germany. I want to say hello to the people currently listening all across Canada and wherever you might be across this fine world of ours. Joe, it's been a great day. Happy birthday. I hope you had a good day in terms of, I hope we didn't work you too hard today.
Glad to be here. And no, it was a great day. Excellent birthday. Went and had dinner with you and family before the show. And we made it back just in time to go on air. Really nice day. And I wanted to just say thank you to everybody who sent me messages or wished me happy birthday. Thank you all. And 30 years old, I feel it already. I actually filed for Social Security today. And my old age, I'm thinking about retiring.
Yeah. I got to tell you, you talk about feeling old, folks. Have a 30-year-old son, and I'm sure a lot of you do, but holy cow, it's sobering for me. But you know, we are the premier, I like to say we're the premier father and son talk show on the internet. I don't know how many father son talk shows there are, and I don't know how many investigator duo talk show hosts there are. And when you combine the two, this is what you get. It's the Hagman & Hagman Report. We're investigators by profession, by trade, by career, and talk show hosts by pretend, I suppose. But anyway, what we attempt to do is bring in the news that other talk shows don't. We've got a lot of news. I just want to make an announcement. For those people listening currently in Western New York, I was on the Tom Bowerly Show today, WBEN. I've got to tell you, all 3 hours this morning from 9 a.m. Eastern time to noon Eastern time, that's how I spent my morning. If you heard me live, great. Let me know how I did. Just drop me a line. And drop Tom a line, especially if you like the show. I already got feedback. Nothing I can read on the air.
Yeah. It's amazing, the hate mail you got. And I only listened to some of the broadcast, and I didn't hear anything out of line in there, but I'm going to have to go back and listen to the whole thing because obviously you struck a nerve somewhere. We got a lot of news to get into tonight. This is breaking out of Russia today. North Korea orders rockets on standby to hit U.S. bases, according to state media. Pyongyang has ordered rocket units to be put on standby to fire on U.S. bases in the South Pacific. The time has come to settle accounts with the U.S. imperialist in view of the prevailing situation, North Korean leader declared, according to state media. It follows a U.S. B-52 flyover of South Korea. And I'm sorry.
Are you doing that, or is that me? That must be you.
All right, sorry. Okay. I know, yeah, you guys in the audience couldn't hear that, but you know when you pull up a website and you have it up for a while and a video starts playing on it?
Oh, man, that just drives me out of my mind, folks, and I'm sorry about that. But you know, if you're at work in a cubicle somewhere and you go to a website to do whatever, to look at a text, and automatically a YouTube or some video plays, it just dry, or those pop-ups, or those whatever. But anyway, that's just my thing. Okay, go on.
All right. Kim Jong-un declared that the Revolutionary Armed Forces of the DPRK would react to the U.S. nuclear blackmailing with a merciless nuclear attack and war of aggression with an all-out war of justice, according to KCNA. Before I had the music playing, I was talking about the B-52 flyover of South Korea that saw dummy ammunition dropped as part of a joint military drill Thursday. The U.S. has been conducting military drills with South Korea and deploying B-52 bombers as part of those drills. The decree from North Korea placing the strategic rocket force on standby was signed, allowing an urgent meeting of the military command early Friday morning, according to the North Korean media. The plan suggests that ballistic rockets would be permanently targeted at American military installations in the Pacific, including Hawaii, Guam, as well as those in South Korea. And there was the Korean War, where we were fighting North Koreans, and we have still many military bases in South Korea. Seoul is the capital of South Korea. I remember MASH used to be a TV show I used to like, and that was based on the Korean War.
Really, that's how you remember what the capital of South Korea is, really?
Yeah, it really is. But, no, this is a continuation of an escalation of what we've been seeing and hearing. Kim Jong-un has been releasing videos of what looked to be rockets hitting the United States and bombing the U.S. in various places. They've been stepping up their rhetoric for weeks, if not months now, and the United States is also provoking them with conducting these drills with South Korea at a time when the hostilities are extremely high. But North Korea would, in my opinion, is moving along an agenda. Probably the New World Order globalists are behind this, and no matter what we were to do, or drills, no drills, they would now be doing the same thing, targeting South Korea, targeting America, regardless, in my opinion.
Look,
this is for a reason, and it is...
North Korea is what, though? What is North Korea? North Korea is
China,
the proxy?
Proxy.
Right, exactly.
But
exactly.
This is not happening by chance at this time. This is happening at this time because it was planned to happen at this time. What will become of it, we will see in the coming weeks, days, hours. Who knows? But none of it's good.
No.
If they do act and do something along the lines of launching a nuclear weapon at the U.S., and we'll say if it were to hit, I mean, we would be engaged in a nuclear war with North Korea immediately.
Folks, this is our question to you. As we had done research here over the last day or two with respect to North Korea, with respect to China, with respect to what's going on over there, is this not an orchestrated chaos? Are we not looking at orchestrated chaos? Because tell me, we'll say 10 years ago or 8 years ago, and I know this puts it in the camp of George Bush, of course, but even during the Clinton years, would this have happened at that time? I just don't see it happening at this time. So what's different between, what's different between 4 years but then now?
I've got an answer. I was saying I don't believe this to be anything more than, you know, basically warmongering or, you know, just talk. I never really thought of the possibility of them actually taking action on what they're saying. And nor do I think they have the sole capabilities to do this. So if this is done, there would be another country involved with the supplying of the weaponry that would allow them to do this, to launch whatever they do. And if something does happen and it does strike the U.S. or Hawaii, part of the U.S. or anywhere in South Korea, I mean, we have defense systems in place, meaning...
But don't forget, though, there was a part of a rocket, a lower stage rocket, and ladies and gentlemen, you might have heard about this, of course, hitting Alaska from North Korea. And people denied this and denied it and denied it and denied it, but in fact, it was verified to be true. And I know I talked to Steve Quayle about this, and Joe, you and I both had conferences with Steve Quayle and his sources. I truly believe that what we're seeing right now is the unraveling, and in particular, you've got this ruling class, and I talked about this on WBEN this morning. You've got this ruling class that's really pulling the puppet strings of these various hotspots, because you've got China and Japan, you've got North Korea and South Korea, and North Korea versus the United States. You've got Iran as a hotspot. You've got Syria as a intent hotspot. You've got you've got the Muslim Brotherhood infiltrated throughout all of the Middle East and North Africa. You've got AQIM, which is Al Qaeda in Northern Africa, funneling weapons into South America, into Latin America, Mexico, and up into the United States. But you also have the drug trade going from west to east. All of this is unchecked by the military and intelligence apparatus of the United States, including what you mentioned, which you opened with, that being North Korea. So my question is what we're seeing, all of this, is this orchestrated? Is this coordinated? Is this being coordinated, I suppose? Again, I refer back to the WBEN interview. Could all of this be coincidence, or is, in fact, is this part of a larger agenda? And I think it's part of a larger agenda. Don't you agree? I mean,
that is a great question, yes. And I do not think it is coincidence by any stretch of the imagination. Everything we say, it's like a chess game. They have planned 20 moves ahead, 10 moves ahead. They are so far ahead of us in terms of planning, in terms of making sure their plans can be implemented through different legislation they have passed, different documents they have released, basically documents laying out the guidelines of how-to manuals on different aspects, from interning civilians, putting them in labor camps, taking over all resources, moving people in and out of certain areas of the United States based on sustainable development goals that they have set up through Agenda 21 and the Rural Council. They have the country broken down into the FEMA regions. They have the NDAA in place. They have the ammunition. They have the personnel through expanding a DHS. They have a Citizens Corps, Obama's civilian army that he said he wanted. They have that now. They have the legislation to not only displace us from our houses, but to put us into work camps. Those orders are on the books. And today, Obama signed into law the Monsanto Protection Act. What does Monsanto need protection from?
This seems like a kind of a left turn from what we were talking about earlier, but I think that this shows the hubris of this administration, in both in terms of the wars and the foreign policy, as well as the domestic policy. It is tied together, and we're not trying to stretch things to tie these things together. But, you know, this was one of the biggest points where I got the most amount of hate mail from my appearance today was, and some was extremely vicious. I've got to tell you, extremely vicious mail. But when we started talking about the connection between or how everything is being laid out, the connection that, where everything is connected, essentially. You've got Obama, you've got other world leaders, you've got this luminous chessboard, which is the world and the chess players, but it's all tied together, whether it's North Korea, whether it's Syria, or whether it's the economy, or whether it's, well, in this case, Monsanto Protection Act. So let's get into the Monsanto Protection Act, and then we're going to circle back around, and I do have something about the globalist agenda here that we'll infuse after we discuss this Monsanto Protection Act, because I think this is a specific area that we need to discuss. So let's go ahead and talk about this. What's up with this Monsanto Protection Act? How can we describe this best?
Okay, first of all, the Monsanto Protection Act was written and drafted by a pro-Monsanto senator. It was H.R. 933,
all right,
approved in Congress, buried 78 pages within the bill, exists a provision that grossly protects biotech corporations such as the California-based Monsanto Company from litigation.
We know that Monsanto is the father or grandfather or the godfather of GMO. What kind of protection, what kind of litigation are we talking about here that they're seeking protection from? Is it because of eating GMO food, somebody's growing an additional appendage, or is there damage to the DNA? Do we know exactly what there's?
According to the Austin Chronicle, the measure protects genetically modified seeds from litigation by allowing the U.S. Department of Agriculture to override judicial rulings and grant temporary permits for conventional farmers to plant and grow genetically modified crops while pending review. Hence, the Monsanto Protection Act, a name given by activists against biotech giants avoiding GMO labeling. So it goes on to say.
Okay. All right. Go on. And folks, if you caught that wording there, I think it's important to know that. So they're fighting labeling as well as other things. Go on.
Correct. James Brumley, a reporter for Investor Place, explains a little more thoroughly just how dangerous the rider is now that biotech companies are allowed to bypass judicial scrutiny. Up until it was signed, he writes, the USDA oversaw and approved or denied the testing of genetically modified seeds while federal courts retained the authority to halt the testing or sale of these plants if it felt that public health was being jeopardized. With this H.R. 933 now law, the court system no longer has the right to step in and protect the consumer.
All right. So it's like the too big to fail. It's the equivalent of the bankers. Now we're talking about Monsanto as the bankers are too big to jail. Monsanto too big to jail. Just different venues. All right.
And I'm gonna try to find this excerpt out of the book of Zbigniew Brzezinski talking about the courts and in the totalitarian regimes in past, specifically this one was citing Hitler, how they turned the Supreme Court of Germany, which Germany was a republic, he said it prided itself on being an independent judiciary aside from the leadership of the executive authority. And
right.
Hitler changed that to the point where the judges became, they lost their power, basically. They were no longer relevant.
Okay.
And I still haven't found the page here, but...
Well, that's okay. We don't need. I guess we don't need to get into that right now.
Oh, he explains it real well, so I'll try and find it. And,
all right. Well, in the meantime, though, in the meantime, we've got. But this is not a small issue, folks. I mean, this Monsanto deal is not small. Look at what this Justice Department is doing. Look or not doing. I guess is more appropriate. Look at what, the subjects of this country are unable to seek any type of redress because of the Justice Department that we have, and because of the years upon years upon years of infiltration to our judiciary. Just think. I mean, we can go back to, and I mentioned this today, I can go back to the issue of the eligibility of Barack Obama to hold the office of presidency. We can't even have an intellectual, honest discussion about his constitutional eligibility without being called kooks or whack jobs. Just keep that in mind. So what are they doing with, what are they doing with this? I mean, it's we have no redress. We have nothing to, we've got no redress. But
not only do we not have redress, they overturned, look at Prop 8 in California. The citizens of California voted to ban gay marriage in their state, and the court stepped in and said, you know what? That's unconstitutional. We're going to change that.
Well,
so even if you vote, even if you think your vote counts, it can be changed for any reason by the Supreme Court or any other executive body, pretty much, in my opinion, that at this point, they don't care. They're in the open with it. They are openly telling you that the world crisis that is occurring and are about to occur is far from over. They are hyping up this propaganda. They are in your face telling you you're the enemy. Not only that, we're buying up all the ammunition and we're running drills in your city with our military. So get ready. We're coming.
Yeah, you know what? Let me address the ammunition purchases, if I can, as well, just to be clear, because I received several emails over the course of, I don't know, the last 18 hours about this, because people have heard different numbers and different things. While you're working on a couple of other things, there was, and I mentioned this, I believe it was yesterday. If not yesterday, it could have been the day before, but this is important so people really understand what we're talking about here. There was a Fox News clip where Charles Krauthammer appeared, and they were talking about the ammunition purchases. Well, Charles Krauthammer, the conservative that he is, came out and said, look, anyone who is talking about this, they're lunatics. Essentially, I'm paraphrasing, of course, that the DHS is not buying any more ammunition than it used to buy, and everything is normal. There's nothing to see here, folks. Just move along. Well, at least that's the attitude. Aside from Krauthammer, that's the attitude of the Department of Homeland Security, at least the head of the Department of Homeland Security, that being General Napolitano. But let's take a look here to see exactly, once and for all, exactly what they're buying. Now, we had done a lot of research on this. There are different numbers. Folks, do you realize the difference, the disparity in numbers that we're getting, that people are throwing out? For example, the information we have right now, and I dare say that this is probably the best, most reliable information about ammunition purchases. In 2012, during the course of one single year, the Department of Homeland Security purchased 148 million rounds of ammunition. And that's all calibers, and that's all agencies under the umbrella of DHS. In this year, they had issued solicited for a five-year contract for 1.6 billion rounds. Now, to explain how things work, if we'll say if the Smith Company of ammunition makers, the Smith Company is awarded that contract, they have got to allocate 1.6 billion rounds directly to the federal government. That takes that completely off the market. Now, that is this year. Tom Coburn, Tom Coburn from Oklahoma had asked the Department of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, for an explanation. None was given. The other numbers that were given out, which appeared to be somewhat accurate. In 2010, there were 148 million rounds. In 2011, there were 108 million rounds. And in 2012, 103 million rounds. Now, you notice I said 103 million rounds just now when I said 148 million rounds just moments ago. There's a difference there of 45 million rounds. Well, the latter numbers, now this was reported by Coburn, the latter numbers are about 50 million rounds per, the 2012 numbers are about 50 million rounds off. Actually, I'm sorry, let me back up. All the numbers I just gave you, the 148, 108, and the 103 are 50 million rounds off per contract year. And that is because of the method of accounting being done as two other federal agencies were folded back into, out of, and back into this accounting practice. I guess what I'm trying to say is this. The amount of ammunition that is either scheduled for delivery or otherwise used, otherwise allocated for the Department of Homeland Security, is this: 5.5 million rounds per month. At that rate, the Department of Homeland Security is not armed for a 24-year Iraq war. The Department of Homeland Security has ordered or otherwise ordered more, I shouldn't say otherwise, has ordered more ammunition than the Department of Defense. So here's the bottom line with all of this, and then I'm going to close and go back to what we were talking about. The Department of Homeland Security has never addressed the fact that they have ordered or claimed to have the need for more ammunition than the Pentagon. The Pentagon, they're actively fighting wars. The Department has the Department of Homeland Security ever purchased this much ammunition before? And if so, during what time period did these purchases occur? The numbers I read to you in 2010, 2011, and even 2012. No, this is unprecedented. The budget austerity that is in progress right now. How is it that DHS is ordering these massive amounts in the face of the austerity we face? And why does the Department of Homeland Security need MRAPs, and what's their intended use? Those are questions that the mainstream media refuse to ask. Well, the bottom line is this. They are preparing for an uprising. I said this today on Bowerly. They're preparing for an uprising within the continental United States. They're going to be using the ammunition against the American people, and the cause, the trigger, is going to be, at the very least, the economic situation. There is also talk about other factors playing into it, including but not limited to terrorist attacks here in the United States. And we're going to be getting more into this later on. I just wanted to kind of just cover this in just give you this thumbnail sketch.
Okay, and I want to add to what you're saying, because I don't think it's only a uprising or resistance they are preparing for. They are preparing for multi-level scenarios that could come in a host of different ways. I mean, you could have some kind of economic crisis. You could have some kind of natural disaster happen,
right.
And these new DHS PDFs, the Army documents that we see, they have listed in there the power and ability to declare a state of emergency and implement any type of changes that they feel that they want. They might not even be necessary. Probably they won't be necessary to implement such as relocation. And I want to read to you six features from Zbigniew Brzezinski of a totalitarian dictatorship. The syndrome or pattern of interrelated traits of the totalitarian dictatorship consists of an ideology, a single party, typically led by one man, a terroristic police, a communications monopoly, a weapons monopoly, and a centrally directed economy.
And let me just add to that weapons monopoly. One thing that was said to me, verified to me from somebody pretty high up in the DHS is, yes, the ammunition purchases are to take off. It's kind of a backdoor gun control. Let's say it's a different type of gun control, weapons control. If you don't have the ammunition for your weapons, then what good is your weapon? Just I want to throw that in there because that does fit with Brzezinski's plan for totalitarian state, the establishment of the totalitarian state.
Further in the book, in the totalitarian bureaucratization about the courts that we were talking about, it says this: the position of the courts, traditionally considered separate from the executive and hence the bureaucracy, deserves further comment. Under Hitler, the judges were at first slow to yield to Nazi pressure, having played a rather conservative, not to say reactionary, role under the Weimar Republic. They prided themselves on their independence from democratic influences. Like the army, they believed in their neutrality, that is, so to say, their remoteness from politics. But the National Socialists could not, of course, permit such an independent judiciary. They rapidly transformed the judiciary, and more especially the criminal bench, into organs of the terror in pursuit of ideological objectives.
Isn't that what we're seeing right now? That's exactly what we're seeing right now.
Yeah.
Precisely what we're seeing right now. What's the last form of defense that we have in this country? Of course, what's the last bastion of defense? That's our judiciary, and that has been completely compromised.
Well, let's see. We know that the Supreme Court is now talking, and I think the last day was for arguments was today on gay marriage.
Correct. Correct.
I have a few sound bites here. This is McGreevy, Governor McGreevy, about gay marriage is going to be an inevitability. And then I'm going to go to the White House.
I'm going to tell you right now, you watch the Supreme Court will in fact rule on the side of homosexual marriage. Absolutely.
I agree with you. I mean, everybody's saying they won't, but I don't see that happening. If they pass Obamacare, they'll do anything.
So at 8:33 p.m. Eastern Time, I just want to go on record on the 28th day of March 2013. It is my belief that the Supreme Court will rule on the legality of same-sex marriage. In other words, the conservatives will lose, or the Christian conservatives, those who speak out, who in favor of traditional marriage, will find themselves in a losing position. So if I'm wrong, folks, just go ahead and write that, make a little note there. And if I'm wrong, please feel free to call me out on this. But and this does come, that's all I'm going to say. So go ahead and finish.
Gay marriage is going to happen, Chris. I think it's almost an inevitability. Not only when you look at the poll results you just put up on the screen, but when you talk to young people, I mean, this is a no-brainer. I mean, there's almost universal acceptance on college campuses. I think what you heard from Justice Kennedy was trying to determine or trying to create a path where he will allow the states to be opportunities for experimentation. But ultimately, I think the public and the Constitution will demand it. And I think this is a difficult time. What I would want as a gay person is full rights. I mean, the notion, as I think Justice Ginsburg referred to it, as skim milk, we don't want a less than marriage. I mean, when you're born, you get a birth certificate. When I die, I'll get a death certificate. I don't want the state to impart a less than status in a civic, in a union between two persons.
That was Governor McGreevy. Now, to the White House, I'm not sure who said this, but this was from the White House. Ernest, changing views on gay marriage, a testament to the character of this country.
Well, I, so to speak, I guess. I got asked this question a couple of weeks ago after Senator Portman made his announcement about his changing view on this issue. I haven't talked to the president about any of the specific announcements that have been made by other senators in recent days on this issue, but I do think it's a testament to something I referred to a couple of weeks ago when asked about this. We're seeing a pretty significant change in this country, where an issue related to equality and fairness is getting more prominence. And I think it is a testament to the character of this country that we are moving in a direction where we will better fulfill some of the founding principles of the country in terms of treating everybody fairly and equally. And what's notable, I think, about this circumstance is it's happening really fast. We're seeing history change right before our eyes. That's a notable event. I think the president himself, when he talked about his own changing perspective on this issue, acknowledged the rapid nature of that change and how significant it was for the country.
What we are seeing is a rapid changing of our social norms through the court system and the executive branch, pushing gay marriage onto the citizens as if it were something natural, marriage being a union taken under God, a covenant with God, and a member of the opposite sex. That's what a marriage is. You and either a man or a woman, depending on what you are, engages in an oath, take an oath in a covenant with the Lord. The Bible strongly states,
okay,
homosexuality is not permissible. Not only that, fornication in general with people who are unmarried is talked about frequently as being a sin, but not only that, it is a sin that is different in a way because, and the Bible points this out, that it is a sin against your body, and your body is a temple, and the Lord dwells in it. And I have to get my Bible out. I think it's in Corinthians and a few other books in the New Testament where it talks about this. But overturning a state's population, the California Prop 8, where they voted to ban gay marriage, overturning that decision is a clear statement that they are going to make sure gay marriage is permissible, not only permissible, but they will be favored over regular marriage. This in an effort to destroy furtherly our culture and the morality of our culture.
If you look at the communist goals that were written into the 1963 congressional record by Representative Herlong of Florida, that was January 10th, 1963, planks 25 and 26 dealt with the morality of a country, specifically the morality of America. Folks, ask yourself why or how this issue could be so prevalent when only at best, and this is a generous figure, less than 4 out of 100 people consider themselves homosexual, bisexual, or transgendered. But that number also includes bi-curious. If you don't know what that means, then you know you can look that up. But the bottom line here is at perhaps the practical number would be 2 out of every 100 people would be considered homosexuals. Out of that number, and this comes from the School of Law at UCLA in a recent a recent study. Yeah, I would say study, not survey. Thank you. But here's the issue. Here's the looming question. Given that small percentage, how could this force, this push toward this redefining marriage, traditional marriage, how could this gain such momentum and find itself before the Supreme Court? I would postulate that the states, and if you kind of deconstruct how this all came about, and this is a longer discussion than we have time for tonight, but think about this, ladies and gentlemen. If a state itself, we'll say New York State, says, okay, we're going to recognize, and this is important to think about, we're going to recognize the union between a woman and a woman or a man and a man. But the federal government doesn't. That means you're married in the eyes of, we'll say, for example, New York State. But can you file, for example, a tax return like a husband and wife? No, you can't do that.
Right.
Okay. And there are 11 or about 1,100 laws that are intertwined between the state and federal government that make this a critical issue at this point. So you've got this massive push to normalize this, to normalize these things, to normalize the woman and woman, the same-sex marriage. And this is why I believe personally that the federal government is going to be required by required, they're going to find in favor, legally in favor for same-sex marriages, because they will be unable to balance out the state laws versus the federal laws. They could just wipe everything out. But I
want to be clear. I'm not. I don't have anything against anybody who is a homosexual. We all have problems that we are dealing with, sins that we are trying to work out in our lives. I don't support it. I don't. I just think, you know, it is a decision. I don't believe people are born that way. But the underlying issue here is we could have, or there could be, a system where if homosexuals want to, per se, be known as a couple, they could have a different system than marriage. Why attack or change marriage, which has been the...
For millennia.
Between a man and a woman.
Yeah, exactly.
Since the dawn of time, okay? And I found what I'm looking for. It talks about, this is in Corinthians chapter 6, verse 13, meats for the belly and belly for the meats, but God shall destroy both it and them. The body is not for fornication, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. God hath both raised up the Lord, and will also raise up us by his own power. Know ye not that your bodies are the members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? God forbid. What, you know not that he which is joined to an harlot is one body? For two, saith he, shall be one flesh. But he that is joined unto the Lord is one spirit. Flee fornication. Every sin that man doeth is without the body, but he that committeth fornication sinneth against his own body. What? Know ye not that your body is the temple of the Holy Ghost which is in you, which ye have of God, and ye are not of your own?
Well, there you have it from a biblical perspective, and I think the Judeo-Christian foundation of this country is a big part of this. But my concern, without the biblical perspective side of it, although I'm very aware of it and very, it's difficult to take the biblical argument away from this. My concern is, where's the money? If we follow the money behind this agenda, where does it lead? For example, who is funding this war against traditional marriage? Who's funding this war against the morality of this country? Because when you destroy the morality of a country, as we have with Roe v. Wade, then you also destroy the country itself. See, we're being attacked, folks. The United States, as the last architect or the last wall for freedom, we're being attacked on moral issues. The immorality part is being thrust down our throat. We're being attacked economically through the Affordable Health Care Act, through the austerity measures that are being imposed upon us, through the devaluation of the dollar. And we're being attacked by our civil rights are being attacked. So all of this, you know, I think coincidences do happen at times. You run into your neighbor at the grocery store. Is it a conspiracy? No, it's a coincidence. Unless, of course, your neighbor's stalking you, in which case, all right, then, you know, it's something different. But, you know, without regard to that, how many coincidences do we need? And the confluence or convergence of events do we need to convince you or to convince others that what we see taking place here is a direct result of an organized attack on this country? And, you know, I pulled something up here, and we talk about, my goodness, we talk about the Bilderbergers, we talk about the Trilateral Commission, we talk about all of these different organizations. If I could just go off on a tangent here, do I have time to do that, or do you want to get into something different, Joe?
We got 14 minutes before the break.
All right.
I will turn it over to you.
Well, and, yeah. Just because one thing that during the time today, off air this morning on the commercial station WBEN out of Buffalo, off air there's some discussion. Well, who's behind these things? And you talk about Bilderbergers and Trilateral Commission. Well, who are they? What's their goal? Let's just take one group, folks, just right now, the Bilderbergers, for example. If you recall, 2 years ago, author Daniel Estulin wrote a book. He was the author of, or is the author of, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. I suggest that even though this book is now 3 years old, I suggest that this would be a great addition to your library. But the goal of the Bilderbergers, for example, this powerful elite group, the powerful elite are invited annually to a private and protected meeting from which world events are steered. Now these people have in the palm of their hands power, very plain, very simple power. The members want to control the course of world events. These people want an empire. And this is what the globalization that we're talking about is. They want to build an empire. Too many people believe that in order to have an empire, you need money and money alone. You've all heard the phrase, the moneyed elite, but money is not necessarily the sole determinant of wealth in the economy. Money does not necessarily make the world go around.
Yeah, and what you're saying, there's a social norms and global environment challenges document.
Yes.
It states government policies are needed when people's behaviors fail to deliver the public good. It goes on to say that
precisely
the world's people are confronted with a new class of environmental problems unprecedented in their complexity and their spatial and temporal reach. These problems involve interconnected ecological and social systems operating on multiple scales, including it lists many things. And what is playing now? Is that you?
No, that's not me. But I can't even hear it, actually. But just to kind of go on with what you said, look, the creation of a global network of giant cartels, more powerful than any one nation on Earth, destined to control the necessities of life and the rest of humanity. From the vantage point of the people involved in the Bilderberg organization, and you can find out who's involved in this. It's been published. I think Alex Jones published the names of the last attendees. But obviously from their point of view, for our own good and in our benefit, the great unwashed, as they call us, they need to create this global network of giant cartels.
They say that for the public good, their policies will be most effective if they can stimulate long-term changes in beliefs and norms, creating and reinforcing the behaviors needed to solidify and expand their idea of the public good.
See, their idea of the public good and our idea of the public good are obviously diametrically opposite. Because, for example, and this according to Mr. Daniel Estulin from his book, the Bilderberg Organization, for one, is working with other organizations, other globalist organizations, and they are destroying the world economy on purpose. This is not the first time this has been done either. This was done back in the 14th century New Dark Age, where 30% of the population was wiped out. Now, folks, think about this. This is 3 years old. As Mr. Estulin takes us through his analysis of this one organization, again, think of an octopus and one of the arms or tentacles of the octopus, it would be the Bilderberger Group, but they operate in conjunction with other organizations. But for tonight and for this discussion right now, I'm just talking about this one organization. Estulin writes or had written and noted that during their attendance or during their meeting at a or during their 2009 meeting, and think about this. Their topics, and this is what caught me for show prep tonight. This is what caught my eye. In 2009, when the Bilderberger Group met, on their agenda was this: U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, his appointment and what he would do, what his tasks were. Isn't it interesting how Geithner figured prominently over the last 3 years? Larry Summers, the director of the U.S. National Economic Council, Richard Holbrooke, was also involved, the Obama administration's special representative for Afghanistan and, by the way, Pakistan. Now, other people, for example, Robert Zelnick, World Bank president. Think about those people, and those are just to name a few. But the agenda, what was on the agenda was, once again, think back in 2009 versus where we are today. The agenda was, number one on the agenda, what to do with the euro, the eurozone, and the euro itself as a monetary system. Will it survive? Should it survive? The development of Europe and Europe's exit strategy. The other issues, Greece. What's happened in Greece over the last 3 years? Economic troubles in Greece. Do we think now, looking back in 2009 on the agenda of the world of the Bilderberger Group, now we're seeing 3 years looking back in retrospect, the very things I just mentioned, three things that were on the agenda. What has come to pass with what I just mentioned with those three issues? But there's more. The outlook, and grab a hold of your seats on this one, the outlook for Japan's economy, what to do with, how to control, and even tank the economy of Japan. What did Steve Quayle's financial advisor on our program last Friday say about Japan? Watch Japan. That's going to be a trigger event. And then some other ones very quickly. NATO and Syria. Where did that come from? NATO and Syria, Iran and Russia, the economic and financial threats to the various alliances there, the consequences of the war against terrorism, another agenda point, the influences of domestic issues on American foreign policy, and lastly, but perhaps most importantly, the future of the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency, and alternative scenarios. Look, now that was in 2009. So every point I mentioned over the last 36 months has, or actually over the last 4 years, has been front and center. Is it because the Bilderberger Group were insightful in saying, well, these are going to be coming up here and we need to address these? Or are they pushing the agenda? Is this the cause or the effect? I maintain it's both. I maintain that they set policy, initiate policy, and then they, well, it's the Hegelian dialectic. They create a problem, they create a solution, and of course, you know, you've got the situation in between. So this, to me, this is so important. This is just one group, the Bilderberger Group. We throw that name around so much. I just wanted to make sure that we kind of take a look at, well, are we right to do this? Are we correct to do this? Or is this something that we should talk about? Of course, given this track record I just kind of summarized.
Yeah. And you're right on the money. And switching gears a little bit, well, we have just a few minutes before the break, something that we were going to cover yesterday and did not get to. There is a law which would fire sheriffs for defying gun control measures. Supporters of the 380 sheriffs in 15 states who so far have vowed to defy new state and federal gun control laws claim that legislation is starting to pop up around the nation to fire any state-elected or appointed law enforcement official who does not obey federal orders. This is the ramifications of this. I don't even have to spell it out. Let me just reiterate in my own words this first paragraph. No matter if your views are constitutional, even though you took an oath to uphold the Constitution, if you do not carry out orders that go against your oath, you will be fired. So they can pass unconstitutional legislation like the NDAA, and people who refuse to carry out these orders, such as law enforcement officials or any state elected or appointed person, can be removed from their position of power by the federal government for upholding the Constitution.
Where did this come from?
This is the Washington Examiner.
Well,
and
yeah, no, this
Dallas
actually
Democratic Representative Yvonne Davis would remove
right.
any sheriff or law enforcement officer who refuses state or federal laws.
That's exactly right. And who is Yvonne Davis? Representative Yvonne Davis. She was first elected back in 1992. She's got her education from, of course, Houston. She's been a state rep since 1992, as I said. But what about the organizations that she's involved in? Have you seen the various organizations that she is involved in? If you follow the trail, who's behind Yvonne Davis? Because Yvonne Davis is just a mere member of the Texas House of Representatives representing the 111th District. But who's behind her? In terms of political experience, it's minimal. She's on the Transportation Committee. But she also is on the Criminal Jurisprudence Committee. But who's behind her? What organization is she involved in? Project Vote Smart. And if you look even closer at her biography and follow the money, you've got people like, get ready, George Soros behind Representative Davis. George Soros. Isn't it kind of non-coincidental that Soros would be backing this initiative to have sheriffs removed from their office if they defy the ban, the federal ban on, defy the federal law of implementing gun control? Why? Well, this is all part, like I said, you look at this octopus, the various tentacles from the octopus. This octopus is the global governance, the New World Order. We're seeing it play out right before our very eyes, folks. It's playing out right before our eyes. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Hagman and the Hagman Report. This is the 20th day of March, 2013. I'm Doug Hagman. With me is the birthday boy, Joe Hagman. And together we are the Hagman and the Hagman Report. father and son team. Let's get people to thank everyone for listening, for staying with us. Hour number two, a lot of news, jam-packed, coming at you right after this.
Hi folks, Doug Hagman here. You might know me as the co-host from the Hagman and Hagman Report, or as a frequent guest on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. If you're like me, you're tired and confused over today's headlines. You just don't know where to turn for accurate, concise information about really what's going on, what's truly going on in today's society. If you don't know where to turn for accurate, well-researched, and properly vetted news, I've got a suggestion. In fact, it's a requirement. Bookmark Canada Free Press. That's CanadaFreePress.com on the internet. It's just not for Canada. It's for news across the world. Judy McLeod, founding editor, has put together a vast array of talented writers like Kelly O'Connell, Daniel Greenfield, Dr. Ilana Johnson-Powell, a lot of guest columnists, very talented writers. Folks, that's Canada Free Press at CanadaFreePress.com. Now mobile friendly, follow on Facebook, because without America, there is no free world.
Survival of the fittest. In any and all situations, survival is your number one priority. That requires being tough and thinking smart. And the folks at Freeze Dry Guy are going to help you do just that. They have a long-range patrol ration entrees, what they call the brick pack. When you're in survival mode, it is absolutely the best item for your survival pack or bug-out bag. You can go farther, faster, and carry more food with the LRP cold weather ration entrees. Not only do these long-lasting, durable entrees help sustain you or your family through the harshest environment or situation, they are by far the most delicious of their kind. No contest. With a variety of tasty entrees, you can't beat the LRP brick packs. Let Freeze Dry Guy help you in your survival situations. Go to freezedryguy.com. That's freezedryguy.com. Or call 866-404-3663. That's 866-404-FOOD.
You better wake up fast and listen to this, America. The Obama campaign has launched attack squads disguised as truth teams dedicated to intimidating and silencing all political dissent carried over the internet that criticizes the Marxist Obama. Truth squads specifically focused on covering up Obama's endless trail of lies, corruption, and subversion, and using the Gestapo power of our own government to police and censor the internet and shut down websites that dare to carry the real truth about Obama's Marxist coup. Remember the names of these Gestapo-style agencies at work right there in your neighborhood: KeepingHisWord.com, KeepingGOPHonest.com, and AttackWatch.com. KGB, SS, and Gestapo-style police state gangster organizations at work to silence the important voices of patriot dissent, some of which have already been shut down by Obama's orders. Adolf Hitler would have been proud. We're the 21st century Tea Party Patriots.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of this Thursday, March 28th edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. Joe Hagman here, along with my co-host and father, Doug Hagman. Together, we are the premier father and son radio team. And I am going to open this segment with a quick audio on what is happening in the cyber world as digital doom cyber attacks as dangerous as weapons of mass destruction. We're going to listen to this quick 3-minute audio clip from Russia Today.
Well, there's no better place than the internet for minimal damage turned into epic disaster, given how much crucial data is stored on the web these days. Joining me now, RT's Alexei Arshevsky, who has been covering this story for us here on RT. So, Alexei, given the nature of cyber attacks, it is possible that one person by themselves can do a lot of damage, isn't it?
Well, cyber attacks may not be as deadly. They're not directly killing people as the weapons of mass destruction do, but in terms of the infrastructural damage, they're just as effective. Take, for instance, the recent Stuxnet virus attack by the U.S. government on the Iranian nuclear program. Imagine something went wrong there and, let's say, for instance, the nuclear facility started exploding. The death toll would have been enormous. Or take the ongoing cyber attack from an unknown Islamic organization on banks in the United States. This is not killing people. This is not directly causing any bodily harm, but certainly the fact that this attack, which has already been described by experts as the longest standing cyber attack on industrial sector, is creating huge financial damage. Accounts are being frozen, loans are being canceled, and things like that. So definitely cyber attacks are getting more and more serious every day.
Could we imagine at this point also the effect it would have if this kind of attack were leveled at a government agency?
Well, the attack you mentioned earlier, experts said that if it was directed at Downing Street 10, the UK government's website would have been down in a matter of seconds. You know, generally cyber attacks have been all about, mostly about online vandalism, asserting themselves on the internet. Like, for instance, the downing of the CIA website by the anonymous hacker group last year. It didn't kill anyone, it didn't cause huge financial damage, but certainly the reputation of the Central Intelligence Agency was seriously harmed by those actions. And another case like that was when a conversation between officials from the Scotland Yard and the FBI was made public by the anonymous, by the same hacker group, also causing serious reputational damage to the both organizations. But there have been cases already, known cases of intergovernmental cyber attacks. In 2011, a very sensitive attack, as it was put back then by the Pentagon, was launched on the U.S. Defense Ministry, and 24,000 sensitive files were stolen and made public. God knows what the consequences of this massive leak was back then.
Now, what are the chances then for warfare in general to go online instead of on the battlefield?
Well, should any major warfare, major conflict happen, definitely the cyber part of it will be something of a new dimension, something of an integral part of this conflict, especially that we're living in an era when satellites control the missiles, and imagine somebody hacking into those satellites and directing missiles in the other direction. Already some ongoing conflicts are being affected by the cyber warfare, in particular the dispute between South Korea and North Korea, with Seoul claiming that they've suffered 32,000 cyber attacks from presumably from North Korea over the past year, and that North Korea is actually preparing a whole cyber squad to fight South Korea in case of a major war. The fact that the U.S. defense officials recently upgraded the potential threat from cyber attacks to higher level than terrorist attacks from Al-Qaeda speaks volumes. So this is how serious it is, and this is how serious it's being considered by the authorities worldwide.
All right, RT's Alexei Arshevsky on top of the story for us. Thanks very much for that update.
All right, folks, what you just heard there is a discussion about cyber attacks. If you look at what, if you read between the lines, or listen between the lines, I guess is the better word, the global elite are telling us very clearly, now I'm talking about the international bankers, they're telling us very clearly that one of the fields of battle is going to be in cyberspace. And included in that battle is going to, or shall I say in the crossfire, is going to be our bank accounts, for one. Look, it was said here recently, don't be surprised when the bankers, international bankers, confiscate money from your bank account one day. They're already telling you that they're planning to do it. We mentioned this yesterday, but now you're hearing about this. And recall this, folks, when Steve Quayle was on, not too long ago, he received numerous, and I say numerous, several, perhaps is a better word, verifications that they are using cyber attacks as a pretext for shutting down at least part of the banking industry. Remember, too, when you couldn't get on Bank of America or PNC or Chase Manhattan? this, more of this is to be expected. Now, they're going to blame various countries. They're going to blame, for one, North Korea. They're going to blame China. The blame is going to go around. But the bottom line with this, and I think the most important piece of information to get from this, is watch, because they are setting up a raid on bank accounts. And what better way to do it than to explain, well, gee whiz, this is something out of our control. Now, hinged upon this, and I just want to close with this, hinged upon this, let me just grab the information that I had earlier here. There is an 80% wealth confiscation scheme in the works, and this is coming from Cyprus. The theft of depositors' savings and their deposit accounts is one thing, but don't forget how they lied, how the people behind this lied time and time again about how much of the bailout they needed. Initially, the plan in Cyprus was simply taking 6.75% of all savings account up to the official insurance limit of 100,000 euros, a 9.9 levy or theft on all deposits, and so on. I won't get into all of it, but this is a very dangerous time right now. This is an extremely dangerous time, even as we see the stock market hitting new signals. And once again, why is this? As I explained today earlier on WBN, the reason this is taking place is the, and remember what V said, the flow of money coming from the Eurozone and other countries into America. And of course, their plan is once all of that money is here and everything is propped up, it'll be like a lifeboat. They're going to push the lifeboat out and sink the lifeboat. This is the plan. Now, I know that if you feel that what we've talked about so far, the first hour and this part of the second hour, and by the way, I want to welcome the various stations and simulcasts joining us and picking us up for the second hour. But if it seems disjointed, it's not, because this is all part of the same war that we're fighting. It's a cyber war as well as a practical war and other things as well. So, folks, just understand this. Understand that what we're seeing right now, you can't really, there's nowhere to turn. I mean, you turn one way and you've got a cyber war. You turn another way, you've got a hot war perhaps with North Korea. You turn another way, you're looking at something entirely different. So it's coming at us from all angles. This is a multidimensional chess game that we're witnessing. The global elite are telling us very clearly that we are in their crosshairs. And I just want to say this, people, and I got an email, well, more than one, about the FDIC. If you heard yesterday Peter Schiff talk, the FDIC has just $33 billion to insure the money that you have in the bank, which, by the way, totals more than $10.8 trillion in deposits. So in other words, hey, wow. The FDIC, I mean, think about that. If you have money in the bank and you're relying on that plaque that you see at every drive-in and every ATM and every drive-up and inside the bank, FDIC insured, well, $33 billion is what they've got to insure more than $10.8 trillion in bank deposits. Chilling? I hope so.
I didn't know this. My birthday fell on the same day as 3 Mile Island meltdown. 34 years ago today, America's forgotten nuclear terror. 3 Mile Island meltdown happened. There are a lot of other interesting things and scary things happening in the Earth. Listen to some of these headlines. Collapsing Earth. Landslides force the evacuation of 300 in Malaysia. A man was swallowed by a sinkhole in China. Continuing in Washington State, a chunk of an island off the coast of Washington slid into the water early this morning, causing the evacuation of 34 homes. We have, locust invasion of half of Madagascar in India.
Right.
We have an H7NX low pathogenic avian influenza in Australia. And then these two interesting related pieces of news, and maybe somebody can help us on this calling in the third hour. An event unprecedented in human history is today, methane gas at record highs. And another headline, record methane in Arctic, early March 2013. The methane levels have reached in the Barents and Norwegian seas, the highest levels ever recorded. The infrared atmospheric sounding interferometer. What?
No, I'm sorry. I was distracted here. The infrared meter that you're talking about, I'm not even sure. We had talked about this, folks, before the show about this the methane levels in the Arctic sea ice. Okay, I'm not sure exactly what to make of this or what the significance of this is. It is a big deal, or at least it's being touted as a big deal. This is something I think that Standeo is going to have to address specifically, because really, what is the significance of this? I don't see it. Is it higher sea levels on coastal areas? Is this what we're talking about with the melting of the Arctic sea ice, nothing left?
They say air temperatures are more volatile than sea temperatures, that the patches where some of the methane's been released surface temperatures have arisen, and the ice is melting in the Arctic, but more importantly, more methane in the atmosphere can heat the planet faster, and methane is an explosive gas. I mean, you can light it on fire. If you had enough methane in the atmosphere, you could literally blow up the world. But there are many other scientific ramifications. But a climatologist, Paul Beckwith, is saying this is an unprecedented event in human history. And today, this very moment, transpiring in the Arctic Ocean, the cracks in the sea, and elsewhere over the last several days, the thin ice is breaking apart and the methane is spewing out. And there also are possible jet stream implications here, atmospheric conditions. We could see global changes due to the methane. And like you said, we don't have very much knowledge on this information.
But someone's saying this could be an earth-changing event that we have to be aware of. I don't understand this, and certainly we would welcome we'd solicit anyone who does understand the ramifications that this does hold. We've been getting some emails about this to research this. We're a little bit shy on this. So we'll have Stan Dale talk about this. But just keep this in the back of your mind. It's supposed to be a big deal. I don't know. But you just read off a mouthful of various earth-changing events or earth events that could impact us here in the short term.
Yeah, and this goes on to say that the major concern is because it's possible that only a little warming can unleash trapped methane. Unzipping the methane reservoir could potentially warm the Earth tens of degrees, and the mechanism could be geologically very rapid. Such a violent zipper, like opening of the methane, would be catastrophic climate and biological reorganization of the ocean and the atmosphere, like it was around 635 million years ago, this article says.
All right, so we could be pushed back into some sort of catastrophic earth-changing event, is what you're saying. That's...
Yes, this definitely adds to the instability of our climate, of our the storms we see. We see them more powerful. We see them very different, the way that they have been forming in the last year and a half. We see the increase in earthquakes all across the world and the increase in their size and power. How is it all related? It is. The fish and the birds dying, the sinkholes swallowing people alive. This is the second report this year of a man being swallowed by a sinkhole, this time in China. Last time was in Florida. Something very drastic is happening with the earth.
And well, you know what, folks, though, and Joe, I remember vividly Stan Dale. And folks, do you remember this? Stan Dale saying the earth is expanding. And that stuck out with me. The earth is expanding. So that would mean that the mantle of the earth, the crust of the earth is breaking apart. Obviously, that would be conducive to earthquakes and earth changes. And of course, could this have? And I think it does. The release of methane gas from within the crust, within the earth, coming out and, of course, affecting the Arctic sea ice. And then I can see where that would raise the level sea levels on the coasts of all nations. And if that happens, you would have a global emerging and emergency event, kind of like in the time of Noah. And by the way, people have a tendency to believe, and I'm not sure this is true, where it rained, the cause of the flood was rain, as opposed to an event that you're talking about, like this, where the floodwaters just rose and covered the earth. Maybe this is something we're talking about. And if you go back to the dreams and visions, I just happened to think of that young lady that called last night about her vision of the ark floating out from California, or, you know, in the ocean. It's kind of interesting how things work together. Let me change gears here, because I've been getting a lot of emails on this. We could almost call this show responding to various emails. I had talked earlier today on, once again, on the Tom Barley Show, about the UN Small, or the UN Small Arms Treaty. And we talked about this briefly last night. People have emailed me saying, well, the Senate has not going to ratify this treaty. And while that might be true, we have to understand that just by being a signatory, and I think this is where the disconnect comes in. In fact, an article from InfoWars, which states in part that diplomats are expressing cautious optimism that 7 years of efforts to reach an agreement on the first treaty on weapons, ranging from side pistols, meaning your sidearms, your whatever you might carry for self-defense, to combat aircraft, will not collapse on Thursday. Now think about this. Despite disappointment, the treaty does not go far enough. That, according to Amnesty International, it predicts it will be adopted by the United Nations member nations, by the way. The treaty, however, will encounter determined opposition in the United States. And here's where the disconnect comes in, folks. The treaty, if America signs on, in other words, if we as a nation sign on to the treaty, we are going to be held to certain standards, international standards, without necessarily having or the mandate of ratification by the Senate to make this a full binding treaty. And people are saying, well, just because the Senate is not going to ratify this treaty, then we're not bound by it at all. But if you look at the UN Charter, it says that by being a signatory, we have to behave as a nation as though it's ratified in various situations. And this is, once again, this is where the disconnect comes in. Now, Ron Paul weighs in on this. Let me back up just a moment here. This is disguised as an international arms control treaty. And, of course, ostensibly to fight against terrorism and international crime syndicates. The UN Small Arms Treaty is, in fact, massive. It's a global gun control scheme. This, according to Senator Paul Rand. Rand Paul. What am I saying? Paul Rand. Go, come on, help me out here. Rand Paul. According to Rand Paul, this treaty by itself will enact tougher licensing requirements here domestically. And it could, once these licensing requirements are instituted, it could lead to confiscation and the destruction of all unauthorized civilian firearms, and it will further outlaw the trade, sale, ownership of all semi-automatic weapons and create an international gun registry ahead of full-scale confiscation. That's the objective of the United Nations. Each state party shall establish or update as appropriate and maintain a national control list of weapons and the holders thereof. Now, very draconian legislation, very draconian treaty. But again, let me remind people what no one is reporting and what's buried kind of deeply in even the InfoWars, and they do a great job, but even it's buried deeply in their articles, is the fact that just by being signatories on this, we are bound by certain codes of conduct. Now, last week, Senator Rand Paul introduced a budget amendment making it more difficult for the implementation of any type of treaty globalist to establish any kind of gun registry or gun ban. On March 23rd, Republican James Inhofe from Oklahoma introduced the amendment. Of course, it passed 53-46, and of course, everyone at that time breathed a sigh of relief. Well, once again, you've got to look at the finer points of the ratification, because ratification by the Senate may be irrelevant. Look at how many times we've seen the Obama administration bypass Congress and implement its agenda through executive orders. They could do that as well. Don't be surprised, folks, if we see this regime circumvent this ratification of the anti-treaty, if you will, and declare the ATT treaty in effect via executive fiat or executive order. Constitutional limitations on government, our constitutional rights, are only valid if they're honored and upheld.
Yeah.
Is this what we're seeing?
Well, let me tell you this. The internment and resettlement operations document,
yes,
it states in here about the UN's role they will play in American displaced citizen, detainee, or other people who are needed to be relocated or interned or detained. And I'm looking for the exact quote here, but there.
I got to tell you something, though, Joe. I got to tell you, this morning, a listener from Western New York who listens to this show, I don't know who, I didn't catch your name, and I'm going to thank you very much, whoever sent that in, sent me that document, and Tom asked me for authentication. Is this authentic? And off air, Tom and I were talking, and yeah, it is authentic.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me read you here what it says about the United Nations. The United Nations is involved in the entire spectrum of humanitarian assistance operations, from suffering prevention to relief operations. Typically, United Nations relief agencies establish independent networks to execute their humanitarian relief operations. UN system delegates as much as possible to the agency's elements located in the field. Supervisory and support networks are traced from those field officers back to UN headquarters. Military planners must familiarize themselves with UN objectives so that these objectives are considered in planning and executing military operations. It further goes on to say that part of the resettlement operations will be conducted in concert with International Red Cross and the Red Crescent Movement. Now, this is important. We know what the Red Cross is.
The Red Crescent Movement is the Islamic component to the Red Cross, which is basically Red Crescent is really not a CIA operation, but a spy operation more than anything else.
This document states that the Red Crescent Movement is found in predominantly Muslim countries and has the same goals and missions as the Red Cross.
Well,
but I doubt that to be true. But yes, there are many organizations such as the UN, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the International Organization of Migration, Department of Homeland Security, ICE, and FEMA
who are going to be agencies concerned with internment and resettlement operations. The U.S. Army National Defense Detainee Reporting Center, supported by theater detainee reporting centers, talk about how they are going to basically group, collect, tag, and put into these facilities displaced citizens, other civilian internees, detainees, and extremists or terrorists, and that there will be a number of foreign and domestic non-governmental organizations also involved with these plans and the implementation of these plans under
now that is frightening.
The U.S. Agency for International Development.
Yeah, USAID. What this document is saying here is these refugee camps, if you will, are going to be their dual use facilities. And I think that that's probably a generous statement. They're going to be used for political dissidents who disagree with the administration or this regime's agenda, the propaganda. If you speak out, well, this is where your destination is going to be. And yes, these are legitimate documents. I have a copy of the document that's Coast to Coast Calling, actually. So anyway, I have a copy of the document itself. And we should make it available. I just have to find it on my hard drive.
Yeah, and let me give you the fusion centers. We talked about this from the DHS GO CONOPS, the document just released by the Department of Homeland Security. There are 72 fusion centers as of January 2011. There were 72 designated fusion centers in 50 states and 22 major metropolitan areas. Fusion centers are designed to involve every level of discipline of government, private sector entities, and the public through the level of involvement, although the level of the involvement of the participants will vary. Fusion centers are state and locally owned and operated. The DHS, Department of Homeland Security, has statutory programs to support these fusion centers. And they have, like I said, all these plans laid out. They have everything in place except the mechanisms by which they will implement these, or the situations by which they will implement these. So what is coming, we can't say for sure. It will be some kind of pandemic or a perceived threat of a pandemic or disaster could bring about this change. Now think of what this change would look like. Could you imagine military and UN soldiers forcing you and your family out of your house for no reason other than what they say could be a possible perceived threat? I don't want to ever see that. Unfortunately, it looks too much like what we are going to see.
Look, if you look at all of the, if you look at the totality of evidence, and this is something that we really have a hard time dealing with as Americans, as people with of normal sensibility, so to speak. And you're out there driving, you're seeing people acting normal, going to stores, going to restaurants, going to movies, whatever they do, and then you see all of this undercurrent, this undercurrent of documents that are setting up the structure for internment of U.S. citizens. And this is what it's for, U.S. citizens, not terrorists, not foreign terrorists, not Japanese from World War II. No, these are for American dissidents. And it's hard to wrap it's difficult, at least for me sometimes, as you see everything operating normally, deliveries being made, FedEx, the mail going, the paper carriers moving, and commerce as usual, people acting normal, yet we have got these documents, and some will argue, well, we've always had them for preparations in the event of, you know, X, Y, and Z, whatever might happen. Well, okay, not to the extent that they are today, not as specifically tailored to the political dissidents that we have. So this is what we have to really be aware of. This is what we have to look at. It's not just this mental disconnect that we have, I think we have to get over. I think a lot of people are saying, my goodness, this can't happen here. Well, it is happening here. These documents do prove that they're laying the foundation. And not only are they laying the foundation, they're building the building for, figuratively and literally, for our confinement. And, well, there you have it. This is one of many documents to lead into that. Joe, I saw something that I just thought it was so great. I just want to bring up, because we're going into the Easter season. I know we're hitting a lot of things, and we're hitting it kind of hodgepodge-like, but I think it's time for some good news. Folks, you know the Shroud of Turin, the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. You know the controversy.
Yeah, alleged.
Well, okay. There's this controversy surrounding the Shroud of Turin. Remember when a piece of it was taken and analyzed, and they said, this is a fraud and a forgery.
Carbonated.
Yeah, right. Well, guess what? infrared tests show now, and I think this is kind of a piece of interesting, good, in some ways good news, especially for those who doubt the authenticity of what has taken place in this season that we're in right now, that we're celebrating. Folks, have you heard this? Infrared tests are showing that the Shroud of Turin may not be a medieval fake after all, and may in fact have been used to wrap Christ's body. The infrared tests done date the cloth sometime, the creation of the cloth, sometime between 300 BC and 400 AD. That's the best they can do in terms of time, a 700-year period, which is consistent with the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, this Sunday, or Saturday, I believe it is Sunday here in the States, Saturday in the UK, I'm not sure, the Shroud is going to be making an appearance on live television out of the UK just in time for Easter. For Christians, the cloth's consistency, it was found, is similar to those used to bury the dead at the time of Christ some 2,000 years ago. Now, this is according to the latest scientific studies. And again, I think that we have to look at this as kind of good news or news that it is of interest to Christians. Now, some details of the research emerged in a book that's coming ahead of this TV camera film thing that's going to be a part of a live broadcast on Sunday. But you know, for a number of years, many scientists argued about the authenticity of the Shroud. The Shroud itself is kept in a secure vault in the Turin, in the Cathedral of Turin, and it's become one of the most iconic images of, well, at least the Roman Catholic faith, but of Christians across the world. It's 14 feet long, and it bears the image, sort of like a negative, if you will, a camera negative, of the front and back of reportedly of Jesus, a tall, long-haired, bearded man. And it appears to be stained by blood from wounds in his feet and his wrists and sides, which match those suffered by Christ at his crucifixion. Now, the findings that I'm referring to are mentioned in the new book called Il Mistero della Sindone, which is the Mystery of the Shroud, which is scheduled for publication on Good Friday, tomorrow, actually today, over there. The authors of this book, Professor Giuliano Fanti, an expert mechanical and thermal measurement, an expert in mechanical and thermal measurement at a facility in Italy, examined the fibers from the Shroud, compared them to samples of cloth dating back 3,000 years ago. 5,000 years ago, through the present, or at least through the medieval times, and found, hey, these are consistent with, in fact, the threads, the fibers from the cloth at that time. But what remains the mystery is what caused the negative image on the Shroud. What caused that? No one has any explanation for that. So we are, and this is my belief, we're being treated, I think. We're looking at an artifact that shows something divine. I want to say supernatural, but that sounds too New Agey to me. So we're looking at something divine, some divine artifact. People say, well, you know, show me evidence of whatever. To me, this could very well be evidence, if you want it classified that way, as the resurrection. And especially consider this, once again, no one knows how that negative image was made on that cloth. So I just thought I'd throw that in there. It's kind of an interesting off-script story that I think because it's captivated the imagination of so many people, the historians and church chiefs and even skeptics for so many years. I think that this is an interesting, and the timing, I believe, is interesting very well, too. So, folks, just keep that in mind.
Okay.
All right. So now that I took us off script,
no,
I thought that was
no.
a pretty good piece of news. So,
okay,
yeah.
And this we were looking at right before the show opened, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act 2013, new CFAA draft aims to expand, not reform, the worst law in technology. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, passed in 1984, was done so to crack down on the huge computer systems owned by financial institutions and the government. Nearly 30 years and 7 amendments later, the law is regarded by many lawyers and academics as overly expansive and sweeping, as it lets the government incarnate any internet user they want. Oh, I'm sorry, incarcerate. You had me on the Stradivarius and the Easter. Sorry, incarcerate any internet user they want, according to former federal prosecutor Orrin Kerr. It is the most outrageous criminal law you've ever heard of. Tim Wu, a Columbia law professor and pioneer of a network of neutrality, wrote in The New Yorker, "It bans unauthorized access of computers, but no one really knows what those words mean." It goes on to say, despite the enormous reach of computer fraud, the Abuse Act is, as it currently stands, it was the same law used by prosecutors to torment late internet activist Aaron Schwartz prior to his suicide on January 11th. A House Judiciary Committee has proposed a number of expansions to the law in a draft, which Tech Dirk says will be rushed to Congress during its Cyber Week in the middle of April. Among many additions, it expands the number of ways a person can be prosecuted by punishing anyone who conspires to commit violations just like those that have already completed the offense. It also adds computer crimes as a form of racketeering activity, allowing the DOJ to hit computer criminals with further charges in court. If you're found guilty, the CFAA endorses more severe punishments for any offenders by raising the maximum sentences available for certain violations. They cite an example here. Of the extreme nature of the punishment. Aaron Schwartz, who illegally tapped into and downloaded millions of scholarly papers from the Digital Journal Archive while visiting the MIT, faced 4 charges under the CFA, with a maximum sentence of 5 years per charge, for 20 years total. Many lawmakers and experts recommended reducing these penalties and removing them entirely. The new draft actually increases the maximum charge. The 20-year penalty, which he would have been facing, would be now 80 years. And New York law professor James Grimlin said on Monday that this was simply obscene. And it goes on to say that what's most troubling to internet freedom advocates is how the new CFAA even expands the law to include accessing information for an impermissible purpose, which means even if you have the right to access the information in the first place, it's still considered a crime if someone deems you are misusing your access in some way.
All right. So what is that? I mean, what's the bottom line with this now?
It gives the Department of Justice the ability and backdoor to pretty much prosecute anybody they want through internet laws. Anybody with a presence on the internet through internet laws.
All right. So this is something we should be keeping our eye on as well, because now we've got another backdoor,
just reading this last sentence, that you can be arrested or in violation even for acts you are committing legally.
How is that possible? I mean,
it expands the law to include accessing information for impermissible purpose. And there goes the ads again.
All right. Well, here we go.
It says that they can, even if you're using, you have access to, as a private investigator, we had access to certain information database sites that you paid for. So if the government deems that you were misusing your access, even though you are allowed and have that authorized access, it can still be considered a crime. And the sentence reads, for an impermissible purpose, which means even if you have the right to access the information in the first place, it's still considered a crime if someone deems you are misusing your access in some way.
Okay. All right. I get that now. Well, I think this is one thing that we have to keep yet another thing we have to keep our eye on. So the internet now is going to be yet another venue of war of
correct.
I was even thinking too. What about the Fourth Amendment? Or what about the undue search and seizure? Search and seizure laws.
That was taken out of the Bill of Rights in 2002 with the passage of the Department.
No, we can be glib about this, but I guess my concern is, how would they actually evaluate what's on your computer without having the proper protocol for searching your computer? In other words, I suppose they could do this through a number of different ways. All right, I gotcha. Yeah, I mean, we can be, I want to be very, very precise on this. If we make a claim, how is this possible?
Well, in our republic, it should not be possible. But in a totalitarian system, it is normal.
Well, this goes back to FBI pursuing real-time Gmail spying powers as top priority for 2013. We mentioned this yesterday. The pervasiveness of law enforcement surveillance of all communications on the internet. The FBI still has this was admitted by the FBI. They have a hard time monitoring Gmail, Google Voice, and Dropbox in real time, but that's going to change as the FBI is getting more powers to wiretap all forms of internet conversation and, folks, cloud storage. This is a top priority of the FBI right now. During a talk last week, and I should bring this up, for the American Bar Association held in Washington, D.C., FBI General Counsel Andrew Weissman talked about some of the pressing surveillance and national security issues that they were facing. At that time, he gave a few updates on their efforts, on the FBI's efforts to address what it calls the going dark problem, how the rise of the popularity of email and social networks has stifled the ability to monitor communications as they're being transmitted. So what the FBI is saying is, look, we've been having trouble, especially with Gmail and cloud storage. Can you help us? It's no secret, by the way, under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, the federal agencies, whichever one, can easily obtain archive of emails. Now, when it comes to spying on emails or, for example, GChat in real time, Google Chat, that's a different story. Now, you mentioned earlier some surveillance laws and other things, but 1994 surveillance law, folks, think of, or just consider this. A 1994 surveillance law, that this is what, now 20, almost 20 years ago, called the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, allows only the government to force internet providers and phone companies to install surveillance equipment within their own networks, but it doesn't cover email, cloud services, online chat providers like Skype. So the FBI is saying, wait a minute, we need to cover these. So while it's true that the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act can only be used to compel your current providers and phone providers and stuff to have built-in networks and capabilities in their own networks, the feds have some existing powers right now to request surveillance of other services. Now, it's known as Title III, the Title III order under the Wiretap Act. And they're asking email and online chat providers to furnish the government with the technical assistance necessary to accomplish interception. So what they're saying, folks, is they're asking Google and getting the cooperation from Google and other internet source providers to monitor everything that's being done in real time, just as an FYI. So if you use Gmail thinking that it's secure, or if you use GChat, or if you use Skype even, whatever, any type of Google Voice, for example, they are now, the FBI in particular, the DHS, under the umbrella of the DHS, is now attempting to intercept everything that flow across all networks. And this is something that's changing and is being pushed by this particular regime, by the Obama Justice Department. So just put that in the back of your mind and think about this. So we're seeing this being worked up and worked out now. So now everything, including GChat, any type of chat, and, oh, by the way, Facebook chat, any type of chat on Facebook, done, because that system of surveillance has already been put in place.
Yeah, we talked about that hit on that Gmail, FBI Gmail news yesterday, because that came out. And, yeah, real-time, they want real-time monitoring your email. And this is a story that speaks to the politicians, some of the politicians, and the way that they view themselves as better than the average citizen.
All right.
The lawmaker, Louis Gohmert,
mm-hmm.
pulled rank on cops over a parking ticket. The Texas Republican congressman got into a late-night verbal altercation with U.S. Park police officers, pulling rank in an attempt to get out of a parking ticket near the Lincoln Memorial.
So this is a case of, hey, don't you know who I am? Don't ticket my car.
And then, don't you know who I am? I laugh because I remember you telling me a story of a guy here in Erie who is on the radio and has a similar situation and said the same thing.
He was
like, Erie is a you know, nationally known place with the guy who he said this basically has an audience. And he's nobody special. Nobody should think this way. Nobody is better than anybody. I don't care if you're the president of the United States or a homeless man living in a shelter or on the streets. People are equal. We are all the same. We are all flesh and blood, created by the Lord, and all under the same laws of the Lord. No one man is better than another.
Right.
Even says that those who are last will be first. You should put your brother ahead of yourself. But, this, along with news of the sequestration hurting the ability for lawmakers' assistants to get food during lunch. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, I did. That was crazy.
Just these, we see the vacations, the multi-million-dollar vacations being taken. We see Obamacare. It's come out now that it's going to raise insurance costs dramatically. It's going to have death panels. It's going to raise individual. Not only is it going to raise the cost of copays or, your own package, but it's going to raise the cost of overall medical care altogether. Doctors are going to, they don't even want to be doctors anymore. They are retiring or quitting at a massive rate. And now doctors have come out, electronic health records. Doctors want to keep patients out. Now, we talked about the electronic medical records. This is a system where they want to put all of our medical records into a electronic database. Now, a database and electronic health records also coincide with a RFID plan, a medical device that would be used to gather your information by a scanning device a doctor would have. The implant device being eventually mandatory by our government. And here is a small clip, 2-minute clip from, I think it's ABC, NBC Nightly News.
More now of our special coverage here tonight, life in the U.S. in 10 years' time. By that time, there may be all kinds of new ways to safeguard and identify all those things that make each of us unique, our faces, even our fingerprints, even our eyes. Here now with more on the future of technology, NBC's Tom Costello.
The year is 2017. You're rushed to a hospital, unconscious with no ID or medical history, but thanks to a microchip under your skin, it's all there. Science fiction 20 years ago, but a biometric reality today.
The technology is based on answering one simple question. Am I who I say I am?
Already, fingerprints and iris scans verify passenger identities at airports. Within 10 years, that technology may be even more widespread. And look for more complex facial recognition programs that scan a crowd of thousands looking for a single terrorist.
Today's facial recognition software starts with the eyes. Then it maps out the contours of the face and compares that against a database of millions, a database that's growing by the day.
What's next? At the University of Bath in England, researchers predict big changes for consumers.
I think it is possible to free us completely of our wallets and keys using biometric technology, if that's what people...
All right. Now, I just want to cut in here, and we can stop it right there. Listen to this, folks. Biometric national ID card could be mandated on all American workers. This came out today on Natural News, but we also got verification from it from a different source. But let me just kind of reference Natural News because they put it in a much easier way to understand. Control is what fuels many congressmen and women and such. But two senators just recently met with President Obama or putative President Obama, vouching for a biometric national ID card that would force workers to submit to a fingerprint, handprint, or iris scan. Any worker failing to comply with this biometric tracking mandate would be terminated. This program is titled the BELIEVE system, which is an acronym for Biometric Enrollment, Locally Stored Information, and Electronic Verification of Employment. That's a mouthful. The ID card would contain digital encryption key, a digital encryption key, read a chip, if you will, that would be required to match work authorization databases. The microchip processing, or the microprocessing chip on the card, would store the biometric identifier. So in other words, you register your handprint, your fingerprint, or your iris scan. It is then transferred to a chip inserted in a card that she would carry for identification purposes. The worker would be required to carry this card, and employers would be forced to scan it. Now, think about that. That is total control via biometrics. Well, who's behind this? Chuck Schumer from New York and Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. They're behind it. Sounds familiar?
John McCain has to be in there somewhere.
I don't see his name, but I wouldn't be surprised. But think about this. If people talk about Republicans and Democrats and progressives and conservatives, it's no longer that anymore. It's just one party. But they say these new identification cards will ensure that illegal workers can't get jobs. And they assert that this one card will dramatically decrease illegal immigration. Their proposal would include additional border security, of course, more temporary workers, and get this, a form of amnesty for illegal immigrants already in the United States. This is the whole package right here. They privately met with Obama. The senator's plan was described as promising. And you know what? Obama welcomed their new ID card law with open arms, and the biometric tracking system would compel employers to refuse someone work who didn't match up in the database. Now, think about this. The question is this. What if freedom-loving Americans don't want their hands or eyes scanned? We live in a free country. No one should be required to submit their body to such control, and especially putting this on a chip. Are we not seeing, folks, and this is my words, these are my words, are we not seeing the basis for the chip as identified in Revelations and elsewhere? Folks, you're listening to the Hagman & Hagman Report on this, the 28th day of March 2013. I want to thank everyone for joining us, and we're going to be right back after this break with additional news. Your calls on the other side, 661-244-9839. 661-244-9839. We don't screen calls. We'll take them in the order received. Stay with us.
Survival of the fittest. In any and all situations, survival is your number one priority. That requires being tough and thinking smart. And the folks at Freeze Dry Guy are going to help you do just that. They have the long-range patrol ration entrees, what they call the brick pack. When you're in survival mode, it is absolutely the best item for your survival pack or bug-out bag. You can go farther, faster, and carry more food with the LRP cold weather ration entrees. Not only do these long-lasting, durable entrees help sustain you or your family through the harshest environment or situation, they are by far the most delicious of their kind. No contest. With a variety of tasty entrees, you can't beat the LRP brick packs. Let Freeze Dry Guy help you in your survival situations. Go to freezedryguy.com. That's freezedryguy.com. Or call 866-404-3663. That's 866-404-FOOD.
If you're stumped, you don't know what kind of gift to give to a friend or a loved one, I'm telling you, you must go to 4physics.com. That's the numeral 4, P-H-Y-S-I-C-S.com. This is your one-stop shopping palace. That's the only way I can put it. I could spend easily an hour on this website. Innovative, fun, educational. There are games, books, weather instruments, unique time-telling devices, jewelry, optical devices, laboratory equipment. Let me give you an example. We all know we can tell time with a sundial. You've seen those advertised. Did you know that you could tell time by the stars? At 4physics.com, you can buy a horologium nocturnum. This was a navigational device used in the 15th century by navigators at night to tell time by the stars. It's beautifully crafted in the shape of a pendant made of bronze and pewter or gold and silver. Absolutely a stunning gift. I would be proud to give it to anyone. You must go to 4physics.com. Even if you're not stumped, that's 4physics. That's the numeral 4, P-H-Y-S-I-C-S.com. It's your one One-Stop Shopping Palace. Any problems that you have, I don't know what to get Grandpa, I don't know what to get my loved one, that's unique, you will find it at 4physics.com. Please take my word for it. Go to the website, but give yourself a lot of time because you're not going to want to leave 4physics.com.
You better wake up fast and listen to this, America. The Obama campaign has launched attack squads disguised as truth teams dedicated to intimidating and silencing all political dissent carried over the internet that criticizes the Marxist Obama. Truth Squad specifically focused on covering up Obama's endless trail of lies, corruption, and subversion, and using the Gestapo power of our own government to police and censor the internet and shut down websites that dare to carry the real truth about Obama's Marxist coup. Remember the names of these Gestapo-style agencies at work right there in your neighborhood: KeepingHisWord.com, KeepingGOPHonest.com, and AttackWatch.com. KGB, SS, and Gestapo-style police state gangster organizations at work to silence the important voices of patriot dissent, some of which have already been shut down by Obama's orders. Adolf Hitler would have been proud. We're the 21st century Tea Party Patriots.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to our third and final hour this Thursday, March 28th, 2013. We are going to be taking your calls this hour. 661-244-9839 is the number. And on any issue you'd like to talk about, anything we hit on tonight or anything that we missed or did not get to, feel free to call in and we'll start taking your calls in a few minutes. Obama. Here's a quote from Obama today. What's shame on us if we have forgotten those Sandy Hook kids. Obama implores Congress, shame on us if we have forgotten Newtown. ABC News' Jim Avila and Mary Bruce report, President Obama today vowed to never forget the 20 children killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre as he made an emotional plea for Congress to take action against gun violence. The entire country was shocked, and the entire country pledged we would do something about it, and that this time would be different, the president said as he stood in the East Room of the White House. Well, Mr. President, I don't remember us pledging to do anything about it except combat your gun control executive legislation or executive orders. And I'm not going to get into this article, but once again, another example of another politician, this time the president, using Newtown as a base for his argument against guns, as every single radio show host and gun control advocate has done since that day. And it will continue.
One of the things, too, I just want to make sure that people understand, I don't think we can drive this point home hard enough and strong enough. The owners of gun shops, especially in our area, are saying they've never, ever, ever seen anything like the shortages of ammunition, of weapons, and so on and so forth. And they are attributing it, and this, a lot of this is open source, but I just want to verify what we're hearing here. They're verifying this as, like I said before, a backdoor method of gun control. Now, I know that I know Alex Jones had talked to, or one of his staff had talked to a gun dealer. I believe it was Steve Watson who had talked to the owners at Blue Steel and Guns and Ammunition in Raytown, Miami. They're citing this, Steve Wesson is, from the Miami Herald. And they're saying that customers were so hungry for ammo that they couldn't even stack shelves with fresh supplies before they had all been bought out. So the supplies of ammunition as they dribble into these various stores are not making it to the shelves. They don't even have time to put price tags on the ammunition. For example, the owner had noted that customers' new shipments arrived on Fridays. Well, a crowd had already formed in anticipation of the delivery truck arriving. The shop sold 60 boxes, for example, of 22 caliber and 9mm ammunition. You're talking thousands upon thousands of rounds in 18 minutes. I make the phone calls, and they almost expect my call. Like three gun shops in our area, I call pretty much on a weekly basis just to find out what the status is. Bottom line is they're not seeing the ammunition. The other interesting aspect is, they feel, too, that what they're seeing and what is taking place is a method of gun control. And I think that we had talked about this as well, or we had this identified as backdoor gun control. Again, I just can't drive this point home hard enough. Understand that you've really got to look at this as de facto gun control. So that's something that kind of fits with what you were saying.
On one more piece of news before we go to the phone lines. White House tours open for the Muslim Brotherhood groups, while sixth graders must not enter. The Islamic Society of North America, a group with the Muslim Brotherhood origins and an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land Foundation terror financial trial, recently toured the White House and met with multiple officials. According to the group, Paul Monteiro, Associate Director of the Office of Public Engagement, cited ISNA as primary means of outreach to the American Muslim community. The Obama administration's close relationship with this group is about more than photo ops and press releases. It is about policy formulation. The input from the Islamic Society of North America is so treasured that officials coached the organization on how to engage the White House. And I'll post a link in the chat room on this story. More of the same. And you notice in there how it mentioned policy controls. Just very ominous the way that this administration handles how it conducts itself, even on things that they let get out. I mean, you'd think with the amount of secrecy or surrounding this administration, they would keep things like this as quiet as possible, but they actually have a very promoted Muslim outreach program, and this is part of it. Let's go to the phones. We're going to go to area code 832 first. You are live on the Hagman & Hagman Report.
Hey, gentlemen. A couple things. Doug, you were talking about the national ID cards. Well, they're actually here.
Yes.
I don't know if you guys are familiar with TWIC cards, Transportation Workers Identification Credentials. Yeah, and I have one. They were designed for 33 CFR 105 facilities, which are basically ports and anybody that receives foreign vessels. So they're regulated by the Coast Guard. And these were biometric cards. I had to go in, get a picture taken, no smiling, so they could, it's better for facial recognition if you don't smile. I don't know if you guys know that. And then fingerprints and all that kind of stuff. So the cards are out there, and the problem has been, and I want to say I think they came out in 2005. I mean, they've been around for a while, but they have had a horrible problem developing the readers to read that biometric data. And they've just now started to get some, approved, and they're testing them out. But if you can imagine, like at a port or some facility like that, you've got thousands of people trying to come in and out, and the card readers, if they don't have good environmental protection, encasement or whatever, they go bad. So you're really forced to use handheld, and you're talking about a backup that's unbelievable. But, you know, to say that, you know, it's coming, it's already here. And we all joke that the Twit cards were a test run for the real ID cards or whatever they're going to be called.
Okay, you know what, just to be clear, and I think I've heard of this before, this is through the TSA, correct? Through the Department of Homeland Security? And the, okay.
Yes.
All right. For whatever
global
reason, I never heard of the... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You can just Google TWIC, TWIC, and you pull up the cards and all the information. And there's a website, and, you know, I think they're good for 5 years or something like that, and you have to go get them re-permanent. And basically all they were designed to do is prove that I was not already on a domestic or a terrorist watch list. That's what
right,
the purpose was at that time.
At the time of their inception, was it affixed to biometrics or was biometrics new? Because I didn't realize. I thought it was I didn't realize it was biometrically attached.
Yeah.
Or attached to biometrics.
Yeah. And there's all kinds. Somebody looked at one. I was working with a firm, and they were hoping to develop a Twit card reader. And they said, you would not believe the information that's really on that card, but, you know, that's buried in there. But, yeah, they fingerprint you, all hands, just like the FBI does, you know, the palm prints and everything. And then you have to use one of your thumbs and come up with a PIN number to, you know, so if they check and say, who are you, you have to give them that thumbprint and then remember your PIN number. So, but again, it was just, you know, at that time, just to prove that you were not on a terrorist watch list. And now they've gotten to the point where if you don't have one, you have to be what they call escorted, which means somebody physically has to hold your hand, basically, when you come onto what they call a secure site. And it's just, and the one thing that I think we're all missing, too, is I believe Lockheed Martin got the contract for the Twit cards. We're talking millions of dollars in a contract to you know, just get them issued. And so, you know, there's that other little piece that's out there. And the...
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Holy cow. Yeah, okay. I was aware of the identification cards used by the TSA workers. But I never, and forgive me for this, I never realized that the extent of the biometric information that they took to compile for the transportation card itself. Holy cow.
This is under the
Federal Register.
Well, it's under 33. Right. It comes back from ICPIC. It's the International Seaport Authority. You know, it's the Seafarers Act, or, you know, it has to do, they claim that we're trying to get level with all the other ports in the world. And it was really designed for ports. But my clients, because I do Homeland Security work, I write the plans and all this kind of stuff that were required. My clients were more like terminals and, I mean, you know, I had an aggregate company, but they got their rock from Mexico, so they had to go through this whole thing, you know, just because they got a ship of rocks in that, you know, came from Mexico. So it's been a real nightmare. And then again, when you think about it, I used to kind of joke that it's almost like another environmental regulation. It's designed to bankrupt, or, you know, it's an added cost. And when you really look at it personally, it doesn't really add that much more safety to the facility, you know, when you think about it. But
Actually, you're right. And that's the key. When you think about how this is being applied, where is that level of extra level of security? It's really non-existent, especially
it's not
in current form.
And then when every employee is required to carry their card, Or they did allow that some of my clients would actually secure them in a locked cabinet, but they had to be checked every day. And, you know, I mean, it's just all this stuff. And the Coast Guard, I mean, I know the Coast Guard has shut some facilities down for, you know, violations of this part of the rule. or regulation, I should say. It's not even a rule. It's a regulation. So, you know, it's been a nightmare. And it's been, I want to say, I think it got implemented in 2000, somewhere back in then. That's when, yeah, something like that. That's when all the plans had to be made, because this was all after, you know, 9/11 and all that kind of stuff. But they hit the ports because they thought the ports were going to be, you know, the next big entry point for terrorists. And then it just got spread out to anybody that got a foreign vessel. So it's, you know, it's, you know, down on the Gulf Coast, it was a pretty much of a nightmare. So anyway, I just wanted to pass that on because it sounded like you guys, you know, it's here. And it's just, you know, a matter of time before they implement it.
I want to thank you so much for that information.
Yeah.
God bless you for that. Because, thank you so much. And ladies and gentlemen, that is the Transportation Worker Identification Credential this caller was talking about, TWIC, which, Joe, as you mentioned, the final rule was posted back in January of 2007. And but the program itself was established prior to that by the TSA as well as the U.S. Coast Guard. It was an initiative by both of those. I had no idea until this caller just mentioned this about the biometric data that it was required for these cards. So that was an interesting, very interesting call, by the way. So that was good. Wow. Joe, did you realize that? I mean, I did not know the TSA required this, or this is a TSA initiative.
For people who are not in this studio right now, I'm giving him the look of the stare of death because, yes, I've done this and I've went over this with you and I've sent you the documents. And
wait, on the TWIC card, the Transportation Worker Identification?
This is part of the Global Trusted Travelers Global Entry Program. Okay, and it consists of different levels of biometric data. It will be iris scanning, fingerprints. There's a list of things you will need to submit in order to be a part of this global entry. And this was done, well, at least this one, the Trusted Travelers, the voluntary program. It is the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, along with the Department of Homeland Security, was done to expedite clearance of pre-approved lower-risk air travelers arriving in the U.S. This final rule establishes a global entry as an ongoing voluntary regulatory program. And this...
But you're talking... Wait a second. You're talking about the Trusted Traveler Program. But you're not talking about... See, I remember you telling me about this.
The versus what?
Versus the workers, the
cards,
the Transportation Worker Identification Credential, which is a program by the TSA and by the U.S. Coast Guard, which provides a tamper-resistant credential to maritime workers, to the workers at the ports of entry, as this caller was saying. Okay,
yeah, the global ID card. This was we talked about this. In February, it was pushed by the Bilderberg Group on having Congress start to. Letting Congress know that there are going to be some legislation that is coming through that will be implementing a global ID card, and it will require biometric data in order to be part of this. And some states already have this implemented.
But wait a second, some states, this is a federal initiative. This is something totally different, or unless I'm totally off base here. This covers about 750,000 people, as I'm looking this up right now. These are for the workers at the ports of entry. This is not for travelers coming in and out. This is not for the normal, everyday you and I type of person. This is for people who work for the work at locations at the various ports of entry or with the TSA and Coast Guard. I understand what you were talking about, and maybe we're talking about the same thing or different shades of the same thing. Why is this important? Because, this is the integration of the biometric system that we were talking about. It's already, she's right, it's already here. But you see what I'm saying? See where my confusion runs in? And if I'm confused, I don't know, maybe other people might be as well. She's a worker that needs this card for identification, for access to locations that are deemed sensitive. So she had to sit and get her, you know, profile picture and facial picture for facial recognition. She had to give her fingerprints, all this biometric information, just to work at this location. Are we talking about the same thing, or are we talking about something different when you're talking about, for example, the Trusted Traveler program?
For the worker aspect of it, I know that in government positions, as well as military, they have already implemented forms of biometric IDs to be part of their process. I mean, this is old. I mean, they've had, especially in the higher ups in government and in military, have used biometric data for years in order to, say, go to work. You would need to, you know, put in your thumbprint or get an iris scan. These things are there and have been there for a while, but maybe expanding it to other private sector areas. And this whole thing is a push on the RFID medical device stock or company industry push, the technology innovation, they call it, coming up with these new products, having these new companies develop these new products. This is one of the top investments, is medical technology, and medical device technology companies are considered to be some of the top companies to invest in for growth.
Okay, and you know what? Now that she mentioned this, I just found this. Lockheed Martin was awarded a $70 million TWIC contract. This is back in 2007. They won a 5-year, $70 million contract from DHS to begin support of a long-awaited credentialing system. So, okay. Now I can see where this, okay, and you, actually, I'll give you a pass on that stare of death. And folks, by the way, it was a stare of death. Feel sorry for me, will you?
No, I was looking at him like I was going to rip his head off.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, you see the wall on behind me is on fire. But no, okay, so what we're seeing here is,
aside from
the military-industrial complex and this biometric program, there's this marriage between the two here. Yeah. Not that should surprise me, I guess, but
this
looking
exactly
at it.
Where I was going.
Okay, all right.
Regardless of which program or policy we are talking about, it is all under the same heading of biometric surveillance, biometric data.
Okay, so I know where I went wrong. You were looking at the larger, all-encompassing part of this. I was looking at the smaller part. I gotcha. I was looking at one aspect of the larger aspect that you're looking at. I gotcha. So
yeah, and I missed.
You can cut me some slack on this.
I just heard the caller. I thought she was talking about the Traveler program.
No,
but no, we talked about earlier in the week about the Saudi
being
given a more preferred travel status.
Right.
But this RFID medical device push is something I've been researching in depth all week long, reading
countless
PDFs.
But isn't that totally different? Because the medical part of this under the Affordable Health Care Act, which is mandated. Now, this is something, folks, and this is important too. You've got the biometric chip device. I don't want to say a chip, but a biometric.
Yeah, it's a chip.
Well, I guess there's no other way to put it. Under the Affordable Health Care Act, it's buried in the 15,000-20,000 pages of what you're going through. Okay, all right, but now, do you know who was awarded the contract for that under the Affordable Health Care Act for the processing for the creation and maintenance of the biometric chip in the Affordable Health Care Act?
Well, what the FDA has done has put out pre-market notification requirements, and they have a host of companies submitting devices and the proper equipment where the, and they might have already ruled on this, on the devices, but they had a period of time where companies were to submit their plan.
All right. Okay. So I guess I get this. I guess I get this. But I'm still not seeing the practical application of the biometrics, the chip, so to speak, in the Affordable Health Care Act yet. For example, when Pastor Paul Begley was talking about this, it was supposed to be implemented by now, right? By March of 2013. Where
is
it?
Some did think that, yeah. And they might not be wrong, because we're not going to see this if things are not brought about through a disaster or a state of emergency. We are going to see this slowly implemented through the VA hospitals, through pediatric wards, and
okay. It'll
start there and fan out. But just to give you a basic idea, look into the strategic national stockpile. Look into the...
Stockpile of what?
The strategic national stockpiles medicines, devices, and all sorts of different medical countermeasures and activities for supported by the National Institutes of Health in order to enhance the capabilities to organize an effective response to a possible disaster. Now, we have the 2012 PHEMCE implementation plan, which is the 2012 Health and Human Services implementation plan. And this includes a high-level description of programs and initiatives that support the goals and objectives laid out in the strategy, a detailed description of threat-specific approaches, and all this has to do with biometrics, biosurveillance, biopreparedness under the Health and Human Services Act, and other corporations and organizations like BARDA, and that's just something we were talking about during the break. It's BARDA has a strategic goals, BARDA standing for Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority.
All right. So I can tell you right now, we're going to have to spend, I don't know how long, going through these PDFs, these documents. Because
well, I have spent a long time, and I have some of it separated onto Word documents, so I got it started for us, if that'll help.
Well, so what you're saying, and I know you've been working on this pretty tirelessly, but what you're saying here is just as this last caller had spoken about her identification card, which is strictly for workers at ports of entry or specific ports, these identification cards that contain the chip, that contain the information, and she mentioned too, there's trouble reading these cards, and as I looked through the TWIC website, I can see where if the card is non-functional or if it's out there, or for whatever reason, you could actually be a non-employee or an employee that's relegated to needing an escort to get to your job or to do your job because of a mechanical malfunction of these biometric cards, which could put your job in jeopardy. I know this is kind of taking it multi-step further, but
they call these schemes that they have put together. These are money generating schemes.
Well, when Lockheed, look, I'm looking at this contract from Lockheed Martin from 2007, a 5-year contract for $70 million for 750,000 workers. Okay, and you're telling me that they can't for 70,000 750,000 workers for $70 million for a 5-year contract, they can't get something that works?
Like I said, the FDA has not only given a period for, and this is under the FDA's own guidance document for these devices, has not only given a period of time for companies to submit their products for pre-market notification requirements to make sure they meet those, they have also said that they will be exempt from pre-market notification requirements under a reasonable assurance of safety and effectiveness in a state of an emergency or another type of non-foreseeable threat or something happens.
Okay, so what you're saying is, regardless if they work or not, you're gonna get it, and even if they don't work, you're gonna get it. But can we not in some convoluted way have some sort of take some sort of solace in the fact that they're not working? I mean, they're horrific.
No, we can't. We can't, because
why not?
They'll fix the glitches, and they talk in these extensive PDFs. They talk about these implanted transponders migrating into different parts of the body. Problems with that. Problems with interactiveness with blood and tissue. Problems with reading them. Problems with communication glitches and the possibility of hacking into these devices or the networks that store these devices. They have even developed the least burdensome approach. That is a document in order to implement this. They call it the least burdensome approach.
Okay.
And they say the scope of this document is limited to the following device as described in 21 CFR, that's implantable RFID transponder system for patient identification and health information. They go on to say it may include a passive implant transponder inserter and scanner. An implanted transponder is used only to store unique electronic identification code, which is read by a scanner. And that's what you're talking about, having problems reading.
All right. So yeah. the documents that look like about 7 or 8 Manhattan phone books over there that you printed out that contain all this information you're going through is all relates to this particular initiative, which is the biometric identification, which ultimately is known as the chip.
Yeah, and listen to these risks. Adverse tissue reaction, migration of the implanted transponder, comprised information security, failure to implement or implant the transponder, failure of inserter, failure of electronic scanner, electromagnetic interference, electrical hazards, magnetic imaging incompatibility, needle stick. It goes on to outline how they can continue with these problems. And it even has a section for software validation, guidance for FDA reviewers, and industry guidance for the content of pre-market submissions for software contained in medical devices.
But once again, can we take some sort of comfort in realizing that this is fraught? This is a system fraught with problems, technical problems, as well as why not?
Everything they implement is problematic in one way or another. It never does what it says it's supposed to do.
So that's
but
a good
either
thing.
Way, no. They will fix any anomalies or problems that they have. They will not implement these unless they know exactly how to do it properly to where these problems can be averted. I'm sure there'll be small cases here and there, but it's not going to matter. You can't take this chip regardless. If you think there's no way out of it, like, I wasn't going to take the chip, but because they were going to kill me, but I heard it didn't work sometimes, scanning it, so I thought I'd be okay.
No, I understand that. I got you. We just went off on such a tangent here, because I think that what that caller said, I think, to me is important. See, and if you talk to me like that caller and explain to me, then I'd be...
I'm not as articulate as she was.
And ladies and gentlemen who are listening to this broadcast, if you can imagine, there must be a couple of trees that are gone because of all of the printing done on these PDFs for just this one topic, and it's more than one or two people can actually go through. So all of this is really ridiculous in terms of what we are going to be subjected to in the near term. So, okay, I'm with you on that. That's fine. But we got way off track. But it's important to discuss this, I think, openly in an open forum like this, because people who listen to this, they may have answers, like this caller. I mean, they may have answers, and they may say, well, oh, yeah, I'm aware of this, and, you know, we'll help you out here with this information. So know that we're working on this. Joe specifically is working on this research, the biometric chips.
Ad nauseam, yes. Or yeah. We're going to 661-244-9839. That's 661-244-9839. We're going to go to 719 next. You're live on the Hagman and Hagman Report.
Hello, Joe. Hello, Doug. How are you?
Very well. Tired, but all right. How are you?
Well, God bless you both. That was very interesting. I liked you guys discussing things back and forth. I called. I have some concerns. I didn't know, Joe, since you're doing all of the paperwork with the trees, if you knew about the guy in San Diego who developed a type of, it's like, I don't want him to call it a chip because it sits on the outside of the skin, and as he put it, you could put a tattoo over it if you didn't want people to see it. That's being worked out. And it looked like a microcircuit, and from the likes of it, it's very tiny, and they use the forehead as one example. They can monitor, according to the doctor that put it together, and I should have written his name down, but he's at the University of San Diego. And
really?
They can monitor. Yeah. I would think it was nicknamed the tattoo chip or something like that, but it's not really a tattoo. I mean, you can actually cover it up with the tattoo. That's why they nicknamed it that. But you might want to look into that. I thought it was interesting because it sits on the outside. It doesn't actually go into your skin. But I guess I'm not sure quite enough if it actually merges at one point with. My concern was, you know, anything that exports data can also receive, you know, like a phone has a chip. It receives information. That was my concern. And I think Ray Kurzweil, gosh, it must be, his son 30-something, so he must have been 20. So it's 20 years ago he did a whole talk about that. It was called Spirituality and Technology, Ray Kurzweil. Very interesting man, to say the least. Anyway, my other concern or thing was, of course, the Agenda 21, which all of this, no matter how much way you go, seems to lead back to Agenda 21. However, the third concern was how Islam fits into it, since they seem to be bending over backwards. I don't know if you're aware of the professor, I do believe it was Florida University, who put Jesus on and then folded it up, and all the students had to stomp on it, and one kid didn't.
Oh, yeah.
And got expelled. Yeah. So what I'm seeing is this huge onslaught, if I may use that word, on Jesus Christ and Christians, or followers of Jesus Christ. And yet, when it comes to the Prophet Muhammad, did I say his name? I better not say anything bad. No, actually, I think calling that book holy just makes my skin crawl.
Let me just interject something here. You know, when we refer to Muhammad, we never refer to Muhammad as the Prophet Muhammad. We never refer to the Quran as the Holy Quran, because based on our Judeo-Christian belief system, neither one are elevated to that level, because words do mean things and descriptive titles are important. So, I mean, that's just us. And by all means, we're not saying, you know, we're not telling you what to say, but this is our point of view. But go ahead and continue, because you're going down a path.
Well, that was not directed at you. It was directed at the mainstream news and whoever's listening. That and Chris Matthews. I'm sorry. I'm still repenting over my thoughts about that, man. However, the idea that we've been catering to this, you know, now, as I've learned from your show, you can bypass this whole security thing if you're... Does that mean if I wear a burqa, I can just kind of walk through security? I'm just concerned because it seems like, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood is not just watching the hen house with the new administration. They're actually the foxes in the hen house. And
you're right.
If
you're
you look at Islam, Islam is sort of one of the things I think of. If you look at history, I've been studying, you know, the history. You know, you had Hitler, you had Stalin, Mao, all of the despots that have killed millions and millions of people. And, of course, Kissinger, you know, did import that one-child policy to China, by the way. Kissinger has a special, when he gets judged. I like to see that one. I'm sorry. I probably shouldn't say that. But Islam is a total system. It's sort of like communism with a religion. And that was one of the things I was watching somebody said, oh, the one thing they learned from these types of regimes was that people do seek out a religion. You know, it's even in China, there's an underground Christian, so there's a spirituality that people seek because we need that, whether we know it or not. And I'm just curious if you see or if anybody sees that, you know, Islam could fit the bill of the one world religion, since now I think there's some act they're talking to the Catholics and the Islamic people. I'm just seeing this sort of catering to Islam.
If I can answer that question, because I got that question earlier today.
Oh, good.
On a different show. Okay.
Good that somebody else.
Here's
that.
How. Yeah. Well, you know what? And it's very astute of you to ask that question. And here's what we believe is going to take place based on our research. Islam is in America, has been imported into America. And folks, please understand this. When George Bush, after 9/11, after 9/11 happened, and the Al Qaeda element of the Islamic political structure was identified as being the culprits, George Bush attempted to, at the urging of Grover Norquist, among other political advisors, said, we are not at war with Islam, and defined and redefined and strengthened Islam as a religion, only a religion and not a political system. But here's the kicker. What happened in the immediate wake of 9/11 was this opening up of America to Islam and the infiltration of the Muslim Brotherhood. You see, the Muslim Brotherhood infiltration did not happen under Obama. It happened under George Bush. People don't understand that. But see, here's where Islam is getting us. It's getting us at the level of the judiciary. That's where it's because through the implementation of Sharia law, they want to criminalize any type of hate speech against or any type of criticism of the Quran or Muhammad and classify that as hate speech. They want to codify that as a law in the United States. So that in and of itself, Islam won't be the single world religion, but it's going to modify our judicial structure here in the United States to usher in a single world religion that's going to be the state religion or the religion of the globalists. I don't know if that makes sense to you. It's a tool, not the end. It's the means, not the end, I should say.
I see what you're saying. And then the other thing was you were talking earlier about the bullets. Yes, that came to mind. When you talked about the Hegelian dialectic, and,
yes.
You know, they're grabbing all the bullets, but I wonder if they're kind of like the drug, you know, we declared a war on drugs, now there's more drugs than there used to be. Is it possible that they're selling, somebody might be selling those bullets to the wrong people? Because it seems like they're targeting, at least from what I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, the people that get them legally. In other words, I go down if I wanted one. I don't. I mean, I don't have one. Probably should, but don't. But say I had one legally and I obtained everything legally. Those are the people that aren't getting it. But the people that don't do things the legal way, the criminals, seem to have full access to everything. So they still are getting their supply of stuff. And then you can answer that. I'll let somebody else call in. But thank you for your, God bless both of you. And bye.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. God bless you.
Have a good night. Bye. Well, yeah, as to the criminal aspect, criminals being able to gain access to things that are made illegal. We'll just look at Mexico and the gun situation there for an example. You have tens of thousands of deaths, gun deaths, and there is a gun ban for civilians in Mexico, yet there are more gun deaths in Mexico than there are in the United States.
Go on.
Just an example. But, I mean, we could go on with countless examples of how criminals and John Corzine, another example, rules only apply and laws only apply. And the reason that the gun control executive orders to even the NDAA, it would apply only to the people who do follow the law, because the people who don't follow the law will be the ones implementing these things. The people who do follow the law will be the ones who will suffer the attacks from the lawless ones.
Yeah, I guess I could. But I think that's a little bit too simplistic of an approach. I think what we're seeing, though, I think what we're seeing with the ammunition is something a little bit more complex than that. I think it's a multi-pronged initiative, not the least of which is to get the ammunition off the streets so people like that last caller and us, we cannot legally buy ammunition or any type of sales would be sold among people who already have the ammunition. I don't see it being resold to other countries or undesirables or people who otherwise can't get it. I don't see that. Comparing it to the drug trafficking.
Look at Qatar. We saw all the Arab Spring protests and riots and violence. And we, as a nation, the United States, decided which protests and uprisings would be successful and which wouldn't. We had Libya. They let Libya become successful, while in Qatar, we gave them the bullets and the missiles or whatever they used to shoot the innocent protesters in the streets before the revolution could get going.
But doesn't this go back to the Benghazi situation? I mean, can we connect a dot here from Qatar to Benghazi, where the arms shipments, the illicit arms shipments, obviously Turkey wasn't the only place. I can live with that. I can see what you're saying there, but I don't know if that would be a mainstream initiative for this. But
we're in the final minutes of the show. We got about 6-7 minutes left.
My goodness, I didn't realize that. Okay.
And you know, I guess one thing that is relevant to our country today, and relevant as it is in the Bible, still relevant from thousands of years ago, is what it says, you know, that wrong is right and right is wrong. Evil will be perceived as good and good will be perceived as evil. I think we can easily, safely say that is the case 100% here in America, where the truth is demonized. God himself is demonized, as the caller mentioned. The professor in Florida had the students write the word Jesus on a piece of paper, then put it on the ground and stomp on it. A student
exactly.
was suspended for refusing to stomp on it.
No, the student was reinstated. However, the scars still remain, or the situation still remains.
Right. We've went over the crackdown on Christians in China, the crackdown on Christians in Saudi Arabia, also Libya. We read yesterday a story about, in Egypt, a mosque turned into a torture center for Christians. We are seeing this huge drive to demonize, kill Christians, and the name of Jesus is forbidden to be spoken on the news networks unless in an evil way. And let me read here just a quick sentence from one PDF document that is what was listed from the SLOT terrorism training manuals to police. These were a series of PDFs, terrorist indicators, terrorist behaviors, and it says this: religious-oriented extremists, Christian identity, the Church of Jesus Christ. Also, it says in the documents that if you use a repeated use of God not coupled with profanity,
right.
This is under the general observations section of indicators.
And we went over this before, but it's important to go over this again. You're correct. Any type of reference to God without
swearing after
without
it.
Without swearing, right.
I mean,
and how sick is that?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And then here in the DHS extremist document from 2009, it says Patriot Movement, a right-wing extremist who link their beliefs to the American Revolution. They are comprised of violent anti-government groups such as militias and sovereign citizens, also Christian patriots, constitutionalists, and it goes on to list a Christian identity, which a Christian identity is much different than what we know to be Christians. But it says, you know, if you are against homosexual marriage, against abortion, you are an extremist.
Right.
Especially
right.
if you're a Christian constitutionalist patriot, well, you are at the top of their list.
Yeah, you hit the trifecta of terroristic traits, by the way. Before the close of the program, I just want to let people know a couple of things that we're following right now that we will report on tomorrow. We do have information, and I'm sure...
Keith Hansen, tomorrow.
Yes, but folks, by the way, at the top of the hour or at the start of the show, Keith Hansen is going to join us. He's got an announcement. We're going to be talking about censorship in the news, in the mainstream media, and some other things, what's on his radar, but he's going to have a very special announcement tomorrow as well. But some of the things we're following, and undoubtedly you've heard of this probably by email, perhaps from other websites, police disarming citizens by force in Connecticut. This listed by Tea Party Command Center and other and others, according to a few minute videos and testimony or statements made. The police are disarming citizens by force in Connecticut. We're following that story. We want to get additional information on that before we get into the actual nuts and bolts of it. It does appear to be legitimate. We just want to find out the extent of it, whether it's just one person or if this is a policy statewide. That's one of the things we're going to be getting into. The other
area.
Yeah. I don't know whether you happen to see that. And then from Steve Quayle, there are some other reports of troop movements in the United States. There was an anecdotal there was a couple of different reports of foreign troops in the United States and the heartland of the United States, and this is something that I'm attempting right now to check with Greg Evenson about to determine the veracity and also the authenticity of the reports, where they're saying, you know, there are essentially some military equipment that's being, well, I don't want to say hidden, but it's out of the way in a forested area in the center of the country. What's that all about? That and, of course, a few other as well.
Tomorrow, something I want to hit on is the Environmental Justice Plan of 2014. The sustainable development aspect of this, what they are trying to implement with their plan, working with the DHS and the EPA, along with the Department of Justice, to better integrate environmental justice, where they put nature above humans and
And that plays right into Agenda 21, and you're right on the money with that. And the last thing, too, that we're going to be really focusing in on is what Russia is doing with respect to a very large-scale military exercise in the Black Sea, how that relates to the larger agenda here and how that may affect us here domestically. Folks, you're listening, or you have listened, to the Hagman and Hagman Report on this, the 28th day of March, 2013. We want to thank you for sticking with us, and thank you for your support, your prayers, your kindness, your kind words. You don't know how much that that means to us. And tomorrow, obviously, for Christians, it's Good Friday, the celebration of Good Friday, that being the marking the crucifixion of our Lord Jesus Christ. We must be solemn and have solemn remembrance and prayerful remembrance of that event.
God bless each and every one of you. We'll see you tomorrow night. Till then, stay safe.
God bless every one of you. Good night.